I think we have the players all gathered. Why don't we convene ourselves? So welcome to everyone. My name's David Campbell, for those of you who don't know me, although I see a lot of friends in the room, and I'll be serving as the moderator this afternoon, and this is the third event in the ongoing series on the public university and the social good, the Provost series, and we are, of course, all very grateful to Provost Ralph Hexter for being the guiding force behind this and the sponsor of this series, and he's going to say a few words of introduction.
Good afternoon, and thank you, David. I want to join David, Dr. Campbell, in welcoming all of you to the third in the series of Provost Forums on the Public University and the Social Good. We're extremely pleased to have as our distinguished guests today Lawrence Bush, Rose Hayden Smith, James Lapsley, and Scott J. Peters, who will discuss making the People's University, exploring the civic mission of public land-grant universities and cooperative extension. Judging by the presentation abstracts provided to me some weeks ago, today's forum is certainly going to be especially rich, presenting as it will different disciplinary perspectives and drawing upon both scholarship and practical experience, bringing diverse views and ideas into juxtaposition and vibrant dialogue, which is our hope today, is a primary objective of this lecture series. For the past several years especially, the 10 UC campuses have faced extremely difficult choices as they attempt to cope with sharply diminished funding from the state of California. Inevitably, determining the right ways to respond to this more austere economic climate has proved a formidable task, as well as a source of passionate debate within the UC system and beyond. At the center of the debate is the question of what the University of California and any public university should and can be in the 21st century. At UC Davis, the Office of the Chancellor and the Office of the Provost and Executive Vice Chancellor have committed to facilitating an inclusive and productive dialogue in the future of the public university. As part of this commitment, the two offices have established a webpage residing on my website in support of lectures, panels, forums, and other campus events designed by or offered for the benefit of the UC Davis community. In addition to complement other campus events, my office has established this forum, the Provost Forum on the Public University and the Social Good. This focused, scholarly series is aimed at furthering awareness and dialogue on this important topic within and beyond the university community. It's also aimed at exploring the potential to make UC Davis a center for the study of the role of the public university in contemporary society. This academic year, the series features 8 public presentations by experts in a variety of fields, plus associated events. The presentations are overseen by my office in cooperation with the university's Center for Regional Change. To learn more about the Provost Forums, I invite you to consult the Future of the Public University page on my website. There you'll find a complete calendar for all 8 lectures scheduled for 2012-13, advertisements and supplementary materials for each event, and videos of past events. You'll also find my opening remarks for the inaugural forum, which we held in October 2012, and which addresses the tasks before us as we attempt properly to envision the public university in the 21st century. And now, some important thanks. First and foremost, to our 4 featured speakers today for sharing with us their knowledge and thoughtful analysis, and to 3 of them for traveling to our campus to be with us. Next, to our Oversight Committee for their excellent work in arranging this and the other forums for 2012-13. The committee members are Martin Kenny, David Campbell, Jonathan Ludden, Luis Eduardo Guarnizza, and Program Manager Alicia Thompson. to the co-sponsors with my office of today's event, the Community and Regional Development Program and the Center for Regional Change, and to David Campbell for serving as moderator of this forum. And finally, to all of you for being here today. Your participation in these forums and your subsequent sharing of what you hear with others is a key mechanism by which the series will help us identify and clarify issues, formulate effective solutions, and create consensus among stakeholders. As I step away, I'll remind all of you that you're invited to remain for reception in this room immediately following the formal presentations. Now, I return the program to Dr. Campbell. Thank you.
So the very next event in this series will be in 2 weeks on March 7th. Jonathan London has put together a program of speakers. It's going to be from 10 to 3 in this same room on Thursday, March 7th. And the topic for that is the contested politics of knowledge in the public university. So we're looking forward to that event. As we began discussing with the provost last summer this series, one idea emerged fairly quickly was to focus one of these events on land-grant institutions. Subsequently, we got a generous grant from the Dean's Office in the College of Ag and Environmental Sciences. I want to thank Jim McDonald, who's here, who was instrumental in making that happen. That allowed us to expand this from a single speaker event, as most of the Provost Series events have been, to this half-day symposium. And so I've asked Mary Delaney, who's the interim dean of our College of Ag and Environmental Sciences, to share a few words of welcome as well.
Good afternoon. I join the provost in welcoming you to this forum on behalf of the College of Agricultural and Environmental Sciences and in expressing our thanks to the organizers and the speakers. I was thinking back last night as I was just preparing these brief remarks, and I recall a very interesting, multifaceted conversation of just about a year ago. It was when I checked my calendar of an evening. In fact, it happened to be Leap Day, so Wednesday, February 29th, 2013, and I was at this conversation representing the dean's office. Wherein the Provost Forum series as an idea was generated in conversation, and it was sort of a gleam in everybody's eye about what could be. The other participants were members of the Human and Community Development Programs, and Jonathan London, Center for Regional Change, and Tom Tomich, also from the Agricultural Sustainability Institute. So it's really nice to be a year later and to be with the same group of people talking about some really important things. The college is certainly delighted to co-sponsor this particular forum, and this is a topic that's near and dear to the passions and the daily work of our faculty, staff, and students. We're very proud of our heritage stemming from political legislation at the national and state levels, leading to the land grants, the agricultural experiment station, cooperative extension, along with a very forward-thinking creation at the turn of the century of the University Farm, which served as the locus for the development of UC Davis, and a location for mission-oriented experiential learning, something we're still doing, experimental research, and extension of knowledge for the sole purpose of serving the public good. Now we're UC Davis. It's a comprehensive campus, and our dedication to mission-oriented activities has never wavered. So as I look around the room, I think it is true that we're singing to the choir on some of the things we're going to talk about today. I think that everybody would agree that our current societal challenges require our efforts now more than ever, but as pointed out by the provost, the fiscal realities of our institutions loom large and certainly could impede our vision, if not our actions. You know, what we do is of such value, and what we can't afford to do is a lost opportunity. And I think what we're all thinking about is how to make that difference as narrow as possible. That's our challenge. So I'm pleased to welcome you. Thank you for the invitation. And I look forward to today's forum to inform, inspire, and maybe motivate us that little bit more. Thank you.
And we're all particularly grateful for Mary's role this year, stepping in as interim dean, and how ably and effectively she's been handling that tough job as we search for a new dean. And that search, the fact that it's going on right now, is actually one of the things that makes this a particularly appropriate time to have the conversation we're going to have today. We also had this week a forum on this campus that was looking at the question of cooperative extension and how to strengthen the networks in cooperative extension around the state. And so as we have those conversations, it either implicitly or explicitly raises the question of, what is the civic mission that we're trying to fulfill here as a land-grant university? What should we be doing to fulfill that mission? What do we need to change about the way we're organized or what we're doing in order to better fulfill that mission? And so today's four speakers are really well situated, I think, to help us think about that. Each of them has worked, is working in land-grant institutional settings, in many cases for long years. They've also, all four, spent time thinking about the history and purposes of land grants and writing about that. And so they have scholarly work that's directly related to our theme again today. Sharing that kind of broad perspective, they also come from very different perspectives. And we'll introduce them all in just a minute more formally as they come up to speak, but just a few things about the kind of mix of folks we have here as part of the stage setting. Rose Hayden Smith, a local cooperative extension advisor in Ventura County in our 4-H youth development program, and serves other roles we'll talk about in a minute, but is going to talk to us about gardening and the history of extension's work in gardening. Jim Lapsley, who's a practicing winemaker and also an instructor of winemaking economics here on campus and has worked with University Extension for many years here, comes from that perspective. Larry Bush, a distinguished professor of sociology at Michigan State and before that at Kentucky, and a long time engaged with land-grant institutions and issues. And Scott Peters, who has been at Cornell in Minnesota and working really in the broad interdisciplinary field of civic studies and a historian of cooperative extension. So the way it's going to work, we're going to hear first from Scott, and then we'll have a 10-minute cookie and bathroom break. There'll be things outside the door, right out in the lobby out there for you. Please come back promptly after that so we can get going with the next session. Jim and Rose will be next up. We'll have another break, and then we'll bring Larry on to bat clean up for us this afternoon. And we should have time in between or after each of the presentations for some questions and comments from you. And the provost used the word juxtaposition. I think that's a good sort of guiding idea for us as the audience this afternoon, is to kind of see how these various perspectives do bounce off of one another and off our own ideas about land grants and where we might be going. So on to our first presenter, Scott Peters, who it's my pleasure to introduce. Scott's been out to California once before to be a keynote speaker at one of our statewide extension conferences way back in 1999. He has a PhD from the University of Minnesota in Educational Policy and Administration, has written widely. I'll wave two of his books around here, Democracy and Higher Education, Traditions and Stories of Civic Engagement. And then an earlier book he helped edit called Engaging Campus and Community, The Practice of Public Scholarship in the State and Land-Grant University System. I was fortunate to be part of this project, and Gail Feenstra, who's here, and I co-authored one of the chapters in this particular book. My first introduction to Scott was actually through a presentation he made right about the time I was thinking about becoming a cooperative extension specialist, and I think it was a conference in Kansas City. And the thing that jumped out at me was he had a series of four pictures that he showed us. And I'm going to show you those pictures right now because they lodge themselves in my brain, and I now keep them posted near my computer in the office as kind of touch plates. So here's picture number one. You might recognize the ivory tower there, existing somewhat in isolation or with a broken connection to the public over here. Some work on building the bridge, maybe draining the moat, and eventually this bridge gets built, and a nice community carnival or festival erupts when we get the connection made. So I, in seeing these at that point in time, I thought, okay, now I know what my job as a cooperative extension specialist is. You know, it's to build bridges, drain moats, bring people together, and then, you know, if all goes well, we'll have some good California wine at the end of the day to celebrate the whole. Yeah, yeah, we were fighting over wines here today. So in the intervening years, Scott has emerged as a real national leader, I think, in the movement to think about how to reconnect all kinds of institutions of higher education, but particularly land-grant universities, to the public. And it's interesting because when people think about reforming the university or improving the university, they often think about things like getting higher quality faculty or just more financial resources, or if you're Governor Brown, you know, getting us to graduate students more efficiently and quickly. Scott's been working on a different kind of idea, which is the notion of making the institution better by making it more democratic, more the People's University, as our title for this symposium suggests. But of course, that begs the question of whether that notion, embodied way back when in the Morrill Act and, you know, subsequent legislation, is just a romantic idea that should be consigned to the 19th century when it was, you know, born, or is that democratic idea somehow relevant to what we're doing today? So Scott comes to this question after years of really interesting study looking at the history of extension, revealing some often hidden parts of that history. And if you get a chance to corner him today, ask him to tell you about going into Liberty Hyde Bailey's old residence in Ithaca and unearthing things there. He's done a lot of very interesting work, and I've said too much, so let's bring on Scott.
So it was interesting to discover when I went to Liberty High Bailey's old house that there were some of his original library was still up around, and this was a house being rented by college students. It felt like walking into David Thoreau's house and a bunch of Harvard students were renting it, and there was his original library on the wall. Not exactly something I would have expected. So I've been at Cornell for 13 years, and I've just started a new position at Syracuse University, co-directing a national consortium called Imagining America, Artists and Scholars in Public Life, which UC Davis is a member of. There are 100 colleges and universities that are members of it. I've started in August, and we recently had a couple of board members come in to work with us on a program review process, during which time I was told, not surprisingly, that that they considered me to be the existentialist co-director. Because I'm always asking, and I am the existentialist, because I'm always asking questions like, who are we and why are we here? So that certainly connects to the theme that I want to raise today. It's actually a theme I've been asking ever since I started my graduate work, and actually before I started my graduate work, it was the impetus to start my graduate work. That question was the existential question of what is this land-grant university thing anyway? Why does it seem to be important to some people at a kind of solemn level, hand-over-the-heart level almost? Where does that come from? What's that about? I'm still asking that question. My work has been a process of discovery and that's still certainly underway. So I've been working with this theme of Extension Reconsidered because I think it's a great title for a book that I hope to do with that title, and I stole it from Ernest Boyer's Scholarship Reconsidered. Because I think we're at a place where we really need to ask some fundamental who are we and why are we here type questions. And certainly we need to do that in the context of the land grant system and of extension. So I've been recently thinking of doing a national symposium on the future of extension. And several months ago, I went to a colleague at Cornell to meet with him and ask him about this idea, tell him about this idea that I had. I wanted to plan a national symposium on the future of extension, get three different visions about the future, and have a conversation over a couple of days. And he just kind of looked at me, and he said, you know, some people think that there's some question about what extension is. He said, there's no question. This, my whole thing is based on question. And he said, there's no question about that. There's no question. And I said, really, well, what is it? He said, it's technology transfer. That's it. And that, there was no next sentence, there was no next paragraph, there was no comma, anything. Just technology transfer. That was a good moment to remind me of the terrain we're working on. It is actually not unlike the terrain of a marooned castle with other people who are somewhere else not talking to each other. Because I've been engaged in conversations for, I don't know how long now, 15 plus years. 20 years probably, with people who have a lot more, many more paragraphs that would come after that. And I feel like I got a lot of folks standing around me, including Liberty Hyde Bailey, who wrote and talked and lived out a much, much more multidimensional answer than technology transfer. Now, technology transfer is incredibly important. Technical problem solving, I just noted at Cornell recently there was a seminar that one of my Cornell colleagues gave about the tomato late bright pandemic of 2009. So there are problems folks in agriculture in New York are experiencing, and there's a role extension can and needs to play in dealing with the problem of tomato blight. But as I've embarked on my process of discovery in reading the history of extension, discovering men and women through the years who pioneered and founded and developed this idea, I certainly have discovered a lot more than just technology transfer and fighting tomato blights. So what I want to do today is sort of talk through this process of discovery and to invite or offer, this is an invitation, a tool that I think we need to use in this conversation about the People's University, about the civic mission of land grants. It's a larger conversation, actually, about higher education's role in public life. And what I want to invite in that is what I want to suggest is the helpfulness of thinking about this, approaching this with the idea of narratives or stories. It is a way of understanding who we are, why we're here, what we're supposed to be doing, that is indispensable, absolutely indispensable. But it also is a way of entering the conversation that helps us see the multidimensionality of this issue and the points of disagreement that are very real but are very rarely talked about in sustained ways and in productive ways. So I'm going to say some things that will not be, I'm sure some people in this room will not be happy to hear and will not respect. In fact, I've had people use words like preposterous in response to some of this. And a lot of what I'm saying is quoting other people. So I'm not necessarily saying I agree with it, but I am saying this is out there, folks, and we got to understand it. So first of all, the whole idea of narrative is exploding across the academic world now. I'm looking at Bill. There's storytelling sociology, Bill Lacey, in your field. There's narrative in education, there's narrative in anthropology, there's narrative in English and literary studies, in law. There's a whole practice of narrative in law, a whole scholarship and field of literature, of people sort of discovering the power and importance of narratives and storytelling. One of my favorite persons in the field is a historian named William Cronin, who's an environmental historian at the University of Wisconsin. And he's argued that stories are our best and most compelling tool for searching out meaning in a conflicted and contradictory world. In telling stories and constructing narratives, we reach beyond the simple recitation of facts and the chronicling of events. We story them. We situate them in a setting or a scene in the unfolding of a plot with characters who act and react in particular ways. It is by storying and restorying facts and actions that we come to know or assert or contest their meaning and significance. So in this sesquicentennial year of the Morrill Act that was last year and the centennial that's coming up next year of the Smith-Lever Act that created the extension system, I think we would be well advised to think about what is the story of the land grant system. What is the story of extension? And in attending to this, there's one thing we have to recognize. We have to be mindful of an important reality. There is not and can never be just one objectively correct way for historians or anyone else to story the land grant system. This is so for two main reasons. First, while history is scholarly work that is based on evidence and historians are obligated to be fair and accurate in how they work with it, as William Cronin has pointed out, quote, it remains possible to narrate the same evidence in radically different ways, unquote. This possibility hinges in part on how historians describe the setting or scene for the events and actions they narrate and how they plot and interpret the events and actions. Second, historians must make judgments about what is important and what is not, and therefore what to include in and what to leave out of their work. Historians working on the same topic can and do make different judgments about these matters. Therefore, not only is it possible to tell different stories by using the same evidence, it is also possible to tell different stories by using different evidence. And while I'm talking here about historians, I'm actually more interested in provosts and vice presidents and faculty members' storytelling. The storytelling we do in our everyday lives, in our institutional lives and culture. We need to be mindful of the stories, the way we tell the stories, what those stories reveal and what they obscure. So now let me demonstrate this by sort of revealing my discovery process that is, as I mentioned, still in motion. As I've been reading the history of extension and as I've been living and working in a land-grant institution, I have seen three enormously, radically different stories, different narratives, different ways of storying what the land-grant system is about, what its origins were, what its work is, how to interpret the value of it, both the land grant system and extension I paid attention to, particularly extension. So I want to share these three stories with evidence from my historical work, not making this stuff up. I'll start with Justin Smith Morrill. So a few years after Justin Smith Morrill's death in December of 1898, Representative William Wallace Grout of Vermont rose to speak on the floor of Congress about Morrill's legacy as a legislator. While noting Morrill's leading role in authoring legislation that created a new kind of college with grants of federal land, Grout asked, "But who will measure the far-reaching influence of this galaxy of industrial colleges upon the future of the American people? Who will compute the result? The central purpose in founding them was to furnish the tiller of the soil such information and aid as would just a little lighten his burdens and, if possible, increase his profits, the former of which Mr. Morrill knew to be heavy and the latter small." So Grout's assertion about the central founding purpose of this galaxy of industrial colleges that the Morrill Acts of 1862 and 1890 established and supported performs more than a descriptive function. based on a particular way of understanding what many people refer to today as the land-grant mission, it opens a path for a particular way of implotting, narrating, or storying what we now call the land-grant system. A couple of glimpses into this story as I found it. Liberty High Bailey is the central character. He was a groundbreaking horticultural scientist who served on the faculty at Cornell from 1888 to 1913, was the dean of the College of Agriculture for 10 years. He also chaired President Theodore Roosevelt's Country Life Commission in 1908, authored its final report. So there's a little story about Bailey that shows up in Morris Bishop's book, A History of Cornell. Here's the story. The rich vineyards of Chautauqua County were attacked by disease. In 1893, Assemblyman S.F. Nixon of Chautauqua County asked the Cornell Experiment Station to investigate. No funds, said the station. Nevertheless, Liberty Hyde Bailey went to look, identified the disease as black rot, and devised a spray which saved the Assemblyman's vineyard. So delighted was he that he introduced in the Assembly in 1894 and carried through a bill appropriating $8,000 for experimental work in his district. This was the initiation of extension work in New York State. The same story, the exact same story, reduced now to one sentence, also appears in one of the most important histories of American higher education, Frederick Rudolph's landmark history of American higher education, the American College and University. So in Rudolph's book, after he was noting in his book a farmer's skepticism about the value of land-grant colleges during the first few decades of their existence, Rudolph wrote about what eventually changed their minds. Rudolph said, quote, "What eventually changed their minds was evidence that scientific agriculture paid in larger crops, higher income, and a better chance to enjoy higher living standards. In other words, an opportunity to make frequent use of the Montgomery Ward and Sears Roebuck catalog. Of primary importance were the pioneer efforts of natural scientists experimenting with seeds, livestock, and chemicals, and it began to have something worth showing and saying to the farmers. Essential, too, was the Hatch Act of 1887, which provided federal funds for the creation of agricultural experiment stations, which soon became extremely popular and effective instruments in winning farm support for the colleges. For the stations combined science and the solution of specific farm problems and helped to demonstrate to skeptical farmers that science could be a friend. Professor Liberty Hyde Bailey of Cornell investigated and cured black rot in the vineyards of a member of the state legislature who one day, as Speaker of the Assembly, would be of crucial help in gaining permanent state support for agricultural education at Cornell." So here's an over-the-top articulation of this story next. This comes from 1931. There was a gathering of what today is APLU, the Association of Public, what is it called? The Association of Public and Land-Grant Universities. It used to be called the SULGIC. It's gone through a whole bunch of name changes. So this was a gathering in November of 1931 on the eve of the 70th anniversary of the first Morrill Act. And at that event, which was all being done under the heading "The Spirit of the Land-Grant Institutions," five college presidents, land-grant presidents, spoke about the spirit of the land-grant institutions. They each gave a talk with that title. And they each told basically the same story. The administrators said an opening scene in the story they told about the origins of the land-grant system, within which an early 19th century American society was undergoing major economic, technical, cultural, and political transformation. In this context, they depicted a struggle between a backward, superstitious, ignorant, and uninformed mass of people and a bigoted and prejudiced aristocracy. These are words that directly show up in their speeches. They characterized the colleges that existed at the time as being modeled after England, with small and elitist student bodies, narrow and fixed classical curriculums, no connections to the common people, and neither the willingness nor the ability to meet the needs of an emerging industrial democracy. They spoke of the growing demands for a new kind of college and a few bold reformers who emerged with a vision of what it would do and how it could be established. They then described the vision these reformers had as one that marked a revolution in the means, methods, and purposes of higher education. So in the eyes of these four administrators, the successful establishment of this new kind of college these visionaries had imagined represented a revolutionary overthrow of an anti-democratic aristocracy of education, a phrase they used. And it marked the birth of a new spirit in American higher education. According to them, this new spirit turned out to be enormously productive and successful, expressed through a distinctive public mission that combined science and service. It produced a fantastic array of accomplishments and results. In his address, for example, President W.J. Kerr spoke of, quote, his words, "Great circles of helpful service that radiate from these centers, service that has changed deserts into gardens, redeemed abandoned lands, evolved new and more profitable crops, multiplied production, created new industries, conquered disease, destroyed pests and plagues, harnessed natural power and thereby increased human efficiency, guided agriculture and business, made science the handmaidens of the housewife as well as the captain of industry, revealed the processes of nature and put into the hands of man the tools that enable him to work with natural law in shaping his own destiny and that of his country." Quite a long sentence. "The spirit that actuates this prodigious program that arrives at such massive results is the supreme and pervasive spirit of the land-grant institutions." This is a heroic meta-narrative. This is the heroic meta-narrative of the land-grant system. It's still being told. I still hear it. There's truth to it. There's definitely some truth to this narrative. And there's no small amount of power in shaping people's understandings. But it's not the only narrative. So I've discovered two counter-narratives, using the technical academic term in narrative inquiry. People who are restoring this master meta-narrative. And Liberty High Bailey shows up in both of them, remarkably. So, in contrast to this heroic meta-narrative, one of the things I've discovered in my work is what I call a tragic counter-narrative. So in the tragic counter-narrative, the tragic counter-narrative restories some of the same facts, events, and characters that are included in the meta-narrative. But it changes the plot line. In the heroic meta-narrative, the plot of the storyline is about how the responsive provision of science-based service democratized higher education in ways that benefited in relatively equal measure the common people, communities, states, and the nation as a whole. A signature achievement of this system, so the story goes, is a vast improvement in agricultural productivity and efficiency. But in the counter-narrative, the plot line shifts. It becomes tragic rather than heroic. As state institutions that receive considerable public funding, land-grant colleges and universities have played key roles in relation to agricultural productivity and efficiency, as all of us know, through their contributions to the process of modernizing and industrializing agriculture. However, in the eyes of some critics and scholars, the state-supported process of modernization is not a story of steady progress and improvement. And it did not benefit everyone equally. It involved what historian Daniel T. Rogers has called, quote, a classic marriage of economic efficiency and unpaid social costs. Cheap food at the expense of education, health, and ambition among its myriad small producers. And also, I would add, at the expense of the environment, as others have argued. Rather than the success story of steady progress with this ascending plot line, the tragic story of the tragic counter-narrative. Let me find my place. Rather than a success story of steady progress, agricultural modernization in the United States and elsewhere can be viewed as a tragic story of technocratic colonization and cultural environmental oppression and destruction, with land-grant faculty members and extension agents playing leading roles. Interestingly, Liberty High Bailey, as I said, makes an appearance as a character in this narrative, too, but this time he's cast as a villain rather than the hero on the white horse with this black rot cure. So we see this in the following passage from James C. Scott's important book, Seeing Like a State. Quote, "The unspoken logic behind most state projects of agricultural modernization was one of consolidating the power of central institutions and diminishing the autonomy of cultivators and their communities vis-a-vis those institutions. For colonized farmers, the effect of such centralization and expertise was a radical de-skilling of the cultivators themselves. Even in the context of family farms and a liberal economy, this was in fact the utopian prospect held up by Liberty Hyde Bailey. Scott goes on to condemn Bailey for being an oppressive technocrat who promoted a future rural society, quote, organized almost entirely by a managerial elite. So, drawing on the work of Scott and many other critics and scholars, we can develop this tragic counter-narrative with a descending plot line. This counter-narrative, basically, Wendell Berry has written about this in his book, The Unsettling of America. His last chapter in that book, or one of the last chapters, Jefferson Morrill and the Upper Crust. In Bailey's version of this counter-narrative, the plotline features what Bailey calls the corruption of democratic and ecological principles and ideals, and, quote, the betrayal of a trust and the disintegration of intellectual and educational standards, all of which Berry argues inflicted a degenerative influence on farming communities. In other versions of this counter-narrative, it's all about a coercive process of discipline and control that was exerted on behalf of elite corporate and state interests. Okay, so this is a very different story. Descending plot line, tragic, oppressive, technocratic, stripping, de-skilling people. There are books that are being published now with that counter-narrative as the central narrative by really, really top-notch scholars in science and technology studies and cultural studies. They're telling that story, drawing on the historical evidence and their interpretations and narrating of it. Now, there is, in my view, some truth to that counter-narrative. But there are also some things wrong, and as a scholar of Liberty Hyde Bay, I can tell you that James C. Scott does not get Bailey right. He was no technocrat. He had problems with his democratic theory, and I'll admit that, like a lot of other people in the progressive era did, he believed science was going to do away with difference. And that, of course, is not possible, nor is it actually even desirable. But while there's some truth there, it also misses a lot, just like the first narrative misses a lot. So in my work, I've discovered a third narrative, a second counter-narrative to the meta-narrative. I consider this one, or I call this one, a prophetic counter-narrative. And I have located Liberty Hyde Bailey as its central teller, its best teller, I think. I don't have time to go through all of these quotes. I'm conscious of the time. But you can really see Bailey flesh the narrative out in a really important passage of his most important book. It was a book published in 1915 called The Holy Earth. This is a horticultural scientist. He also wrote a book called What is Democracy? And he wrote poetry. In a section of that book called The Democratic Basis of Agriculture, Bailey positioned the story of the creation of land-grant colleges of agriculture within the larger story of the struggle for freedom and liberty. He assumed a sweeping historical perspective on the human quest for liberty. His prose was suffused with the high rhetoric of the era, full of parallelism and iteration. For years without number, Bailey wrote, for years that run into the centuries when men have slaughtered each other on many fields, thinking they were on the fields of honor, when many awful despotisms have ground men into the dust, the despotisms thinking themselves divine, for all these years there have been men on the land wishing to see the light, trying to make mankind hear, hoping but never realizing. They have been the pawns on the great battlefields, men taken out of the peasantries to be hurled against other men they did not know, and for no rewards except further enslavement. They may have even been developed to a high degree of manual or technical skill that they might better support governments to make conquests. They have been on the bottom, upholding the whole superstructure and pressed into the earth by the weight of it. This is a grand narrative, of human history. He goes on from that grand narrative to say that the 19th century has brought a parting of the ways from this tragic story. a way that foretold the end of this terrible history of oppression. During this time, farmers and others at the bottom began to receive recognition not only for the economic value of their work, but also, and according to Bailey, most importantly, for their humanity and dignity and their agency and standing as citizens. In his view, this multidimensional recognition was what inspired the creation of the United States Department of Agriculture and land-grant colleges of agriculture. Land-grant colleges, agricultural experiment stations in 1887, and finally, this national cooperative extension system in 1914. Bailey wrote, quote, "A new agency has been created in the Agricultural Extension Act, which was signed by President Wilson on the 8th of May of 1914. Bailey wrote that the passage of the Smith-Lever Act that established the extension system brought a, quote, new instrumentality in the world. A new instrumentality that has now received the sanction of a whole people, and it almost staggers one when one even partly comprehends the tremendous consequences that in all likelihood will come of it." Conceptualizing extension work in political rather than narrowly technical terms, he pointed to the problem of relating, quote, "all this public work to the development of a democracy. I am not thinking so much of the development of a form of government as of real development, real democratic expression on the part of the people. Agriculture is our basic industry. As we organize its affairs, so to a great degree shall we secure the results in society in general." This is a prophetic counter-narrative that goes back through a sweeping view of human history and positions who we are and what we're supposed to be doing in a very different story. Not incompatible with the first story, necessarily. Maybe a little bit, some people think. I recently wrote the afterword to Ruby Greensmith's History of Cornell Cooperative Extension. Bill, you'll be happy to know that I talked Cornell University Press into republishing the History of Cornell University Cooperative Extension for Cornell's sesquicentennial, which is going to be in 2015. You know what she called her book? The People's Colleges. What is the title for this event today? The People's University? The People's Colleges. I read her 600-some page book closely, which I hadn't done before, in writing this afterward, and I am still in awe of this woman who grew up on a farm in Indiana. His father was a doctor who died when she was young. Her mother managed to send her and her sister to Stanford, where she got a bachelor's degree and met and married Mr. Albert Smith, who came to be dean of engineering college at Cornell, and she did a PhD at Cornell. And then worked for 3 decades directing the home demonstration work for New York State. Reading her book was a revelation. It was all the prophetic narrative. And it was one of the most humbling things I think I've read, ever. Because when I look at the world that I've been in at Cornell, I don't see what she's showing us. So I want to say that in her book, there is a paragraph that is easily the most important paragraph in the book, and which captures the essence of this prophetic counter-narrative that I'm trying to communicate briefly here. So here's what Ruby Greensmith wrote in 1949. "Extension workers need to have faith in spiritual values and to recognize the human relationships that contribute to what the ancient Greeks called the good life. They should believe that in the kind of homes, farms, and industries which are the goals of the extension service, man cannot live by bread alone. That it is not enough for people to have food, shelter, and clothing. That they aspire also to find appreciation, respect for individuality and human dignity, affection, ideals, and opportunity. These are the satisfactions that belong to democratic living." So what she's doing is positioning the story of who we are and what we do, the story of the land-grant system and extension, in the story of the pursuit of the satisfactions of democratic living and their promotion for everyone. A lot of other quotes I wish I could read you from her book. that I will skip. But I will say, and Bill's here, I want to say it because he's here, he knows what I'm talking about here. The Farm Bureau was founded in New York State, and some people, certainly the people in the tragic counter-narrative, don't have a high view of the Farm Bureau. But one of the things Ruby Greene-Smith quoted in her book was a passage from the Farm Bureau Creed, which was written by one of Bill's predecessors when he was at Cornell, M.C. Burritt, who directed Cornell Cooperative Extension in the 1920s. So here's a passage of that showed up in that Farm Bureau Creed. We believe in self-help for ourselves, our community, and our country, in our own abilities well-developed and properly supported to solve our own problems, and in local and voluntary leadership. We believe in a program, a definite, carefully considered plan of work, local in conception and in character, which looks toward the solution of the problems which are vital to the welfare of the farm and the home. This plan of action for the organization should be made at home by those most concerned, but with the best expert advice and assistance. We believe in partnership between farmers and the public agricultural agencies, between practice and science, for the working out of this program. That is an expression, gritty, mud on the boots, feet on the ground expression of a democratic aspiration, of people saying, we want to experience the satisfactions of democratic living, which means we get to do that. So let me switch in ending here to the present. This is not just historical dreaminess from an existential person up here who is moved by Ruby Greene-Smith and Liberty High Bailey and a lot of the men and women I've met in my discovery process. It's not just that. This is stuff that's still alive and well, maybe not so well. I'm worried about how well it is, how much it can, how longer it can last. Depends on decisions we make and abilities of understanding and arguing and defending, I think, and improving. And I want to illustrate this with another little story from one of my Cornell colleagues. And I will, I guess, name the name here. I think we have to do that at some point. So I won't name all the names, but her name is Corrine Ketterings. She's a professor in the Department of Animal Science. And she has a program that's built on nutrient management, working with dairy farmers. And the key thing she works on is helping them figure out how they need to change their practices, basically so they're abiding by the law and regulations, and so they're not polluting the Chesapeake Bay, which is the watershed that a lot of New York State is sitting on top of. Are part of. So I had a meeting after my last book. I took a bunch of people out to dinner who were part of that project and gave them a free dinner, and we had a conversation about the land-grant mission, and the only thing I remember from that meeting was her pounding her fist on the table and telling this story. Here's what she said. Yesterday I was in a meeting, and I asked somebody high up in the administration in our college a point-blank question. The question was, in your interaction with our stakeholders, what do they want from us? And the response was the same as always, and that I don't buy. So I said, same as always? I recorded this conversation, which is why I can do this exactly. And I said, same as always? And one of my colleagues who was there said sarcastically, the best scientific knowledge on X? And Corrine said, no. The response I got was, quote, somebody on the other end of the phone line that tells them what to do. My experience, she went on to say, my experience is so opposite of that that I was floored by that response. I work with dairy farmers, and what farmers want from us is not an answer. They want us to partner with them to find solutions. There is certainly a fraction of the farming community that wants to pick up the phone, ask me a question, get an answer, and implement it. But the ones that are progressive, the ones that we should be working with to move forward in the state of New York are the ones that say, what do you think of this? Can we put something in place to get some answers? They're working towards networks of on-farm research. They want us to be partners in finding answers. They don't want us to give them the answer. That is a modern-day expression of the satisfactions of democratic living. And it is not disconnected from the scientific expertise of a professor in animal science who's got a lot to bring to the table, to the project of helping dairy farmers do nutrient management in a way that's environmentally responsible and economically rewarding. It is interwoven with that work. And that, I want to suggest, is what the best, the land-grant spirit and mission at its very best has embodied. And what that embodies is something that Corinne herself has never thought about, but which I want to invite her to think about and us to think about. It embodies the most important sentence of the Morrill Act of 1862. And that is the charge of promoting a liberal and practical education for the industrial classes and the several pursuits and professions of life. The practical part is, what do I do about nutrient management? The liberal part is thinking about, how do we be environmentally responsible people? How do we build our communities? What do we believe in? What do we value? What do we want to fight for and preserve? Being invited into a conversation about that is an invitation to civic learning. And when you do it, not sitting off in some classroom dreaming about the ancient Greeks, but you're sitting on a dairy farm in New York State, that's really something. So the way I see it, we've been handed something down through the generations that is profoundly powerful. We should be the leaders. We in the land-grant system should be the leaders of the national and international public engagement movement that is beginning to take place in higher education. And yet, I can tell you from the position I'm in now and even before that, that people in a lot of the rest of higher ed don't know anything about this. Or what they think is the, either they think mostly, the tragic counter-narrative. Oh yeah, you're the people that's wrecked the environment. You're the ones that are in bed with agribusiness. Forget about you people. We need to engage these three narratives. We need to figure out how to work our way through the truths that each of them have, and somehow craft and live out a narrative that works off of all three of those narratives. There is, by the way, in this prophetic counter-narrative, a set of measures. We're all interested in assessment and evaluation now. There's a really important measure in that. How does our work enhance or diminish the civic agency of ordinary folks? That's a really important assessment measure. I'm not sure how easy that's going to be to quantify it. Somebody told me recently that someone at a meeting asked, so how would you have, what was the logic model you would have asked Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement to abide by for the money you would have given them? The response was, It's sort of like that with this. Let me end with this. Back to narrative and the importance of story. I think we need to believe that there are tools in translational research, for example, evidence-based programming is something people are talking a lot about. But I also think we should understand that for many of our problems, there are no formulas or recipes, that, in fact, things have to be worked out in context, with people rolling their sleeves up, talking to each other, building relationships, trying things, learning from it. One of the things we need to do with this invitation with story is to listen to something that Alastair MacIntyre once wrote, a moral philosopher. MacIntyre wrote, "I can only answer the question, what am I to do? If I can answer the prior question, of what story or stories do I find myself a part?" It makes a big difference how we answer that prior question. Are we the technical problem solvers with the clipboards and the white jackets, the white lab coats? Sometimes we are. It's an important role to play. Is that all we are? Or is there something else? To see why it's so important how we answer this question, let me close again with William Cronin. Give him the last word. Cronin has written this: "Narratives remain our chief moral compass in the world. because we use them to motivate and explain our actions. The stories we tell change the way we act in the world. Thank you.
So we have some time to questions and comments for Scott, and floor's open.
In terms of measurement, would not a measure be that over the past, say, 25 years or more, we have seen that the cost of food has diminished? And who benefits most in terms of social good? Is people of lower income who spend a larger proportion of their income for food? Isn't this a self-evident social good of agriculture research and extension?
Is Gail still here? I don't want to put you in the hot seat for answering that. You know, I think, the tragic, obviously the tragic counter-narrative would take issue with what you just said. And I discovered that Justin Smith Morrill used the phrase cheap food in a speech on the floor of Congress in 1862. So from the beginning, there was this idea. And of course, one of the things that, in that time, he was concerned about, and actually wrote this, which was also a little surprising for me to find, he was worried about the competitiveness of the U.S. economy in the global market. It's in the 1860s. One of the ways you be competitive is you have in the industrial sector be able to pay lower wages. And they can pay lower wages if you have cheaper food. I mean, that's part of our historical reality. Now, whether you don't agree with that?
Well, I think you're warping the argument.
Well, no, I'm just simply saying that that's part of the conversation. That's part of what historians have written. That's part of what critics have said. But I would, as I've said with all of these, I think there are truths across all of these narratives. I don't think they're simple black and white. I think it matters how you look at this, and I think it's a debate we need to engage using our best intellectual capabilities. There's been too much, and one of the stories, look, when I did my PhD in Minnesota, and I did a whole bunch of interviews with people. One of the first interviews I did was with somebody who was telling me about when he was a student in South Dakota State University, the dean of the college, Jim Hightower's Hard Tomatoes, Hard Times book came out. And the dean of the college, this is a story, right? So who knows if it's true. But the story he told me was the dean ordered that all copies be removed from the bookstore and burned. And he ordered faculty not to use the book in classes. That's ridiculous. We're better than that, right? I mean, we can have a conversation. We can have a debate about these things. We don't need to be just, and that goes for everybody on every side of this, right? Because I know a lot of critics who are not willing to entertain that the land-grant system has anything good about it. They think the history is nothing but this oppressive colonialist project. And I have to say, you're missing something. It is more than that. And it was more than that, and it is more than that. So I think this is I think it's a debate we need to entertain with our best intellectual abilities. You know, I don't have the expertise to answer you with the kind of evidence that some of the other people in this room might be able to, but so that's my response.
Yeah, I think if we buy multiple narratives, each with some truth, one of the things we have to buy is maybe the need for multiple indicators. So cheap food might be one of them, but there's going to be others as well that need to be part of the mix. Yeah.
Along that vein, I think the theoretical question before us is how is knowledge to be democratically constructed, attained, and applied? And, you know, I'm sitting here next to Esau, who was here at the beginning of the Applied Behavioral Studies Department. Look at his curriculum. Look what they aimed to do when they started that out. The answer to that question is done in the practice of it. That's where you're going to get the theory. And we're at UC Davis. What we've done, you know, the Farm Bureau was housed at Berkeley for decades. Why not the Grange? Why create another institution for the land grant to partner with, the Braceros program. The Braceros program, where the labor was going to be applied on industrial farms, the UC system articulated where we were going to send those Braceros workers. The construction of the tomato harvester, which we all know, and the GMOs that we're doing now. So we're highly, I think, implicated in what we've realized in our success, which is the San Joaquin Valley. Fresno's the poorest city in the United States. The 20th Congressional District, Jim Costa's, just before it was redistricted, was the poorest congressional district in the United States. And it's the richest agricultural region in the history of the world. We're implicated in this. And Jonathan's work, many of you are still now problem solving the results of our success. We were very successful in one thing, but the questions being raised by Scott are applicable to that. We need to theorize how to do democratic knowledge production.
Others? That was terrific. Thanks so much for that vision. And I'm intrigued by the idea of the prophetic vision and thinking about prophets as both being social critics, but also holding some kind of vision of the promised land. And so you've laid out, I think, a backward look to some degree of a social critique and a description of origins of the land grant. I'm wondering, given your current work in imagining America, restoring America, what that prophetic vision of the university is that you see going forward? Where are we headed? Where ought we be headed in practical terms, practical prophecy?
Yeah, well, that's the work that I'm engaging now with colleagues across the country, including UC Davis, which is a member of Imagine America. certainly we're in a landscape where people are now offering certain dystopian views of the future. People are making predictions that within, 15 years or something, more than half of all college credits will be earned online. The majority, the numerical majority of veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan are students of the University of Phoenix, and as opposed to the 3,000 or 4,000 other institutions in the country. MOOCs that are now emerging. I mean, people are beginning to do this dystopian view of education, which in one view utterly disconnects it from context. Even campus bricks and mortars, people are talking about the end of bricks and mortars. And so whatever truth there is to the power and momentum of those trends and whatever value there might be in all of that, it is the project for us to envision a future that enables folks in higher education to make contributions to the world through the use of the resources, intellectual and otherwise, of these institutions. In ways that, and look, this is where the conversation runs off the neutral, disinterested, objective observer rails, and I'm obviously not coming to you as one of those people, and I don't think any honest view of the land grant system and its history could be presented that way. At least it can only be when you ignore Ruby Green Smith and Liberty High Bailey, because these people were fiercely biased in favor of certain kind of democratic values, and for Bailey, agricultural sustainability. He wrote about self-sustaining agriculture in the 19th century quite powerfully. They were trying to contribute to something in the world more than just offering fact sheets or accurate descriptions or predictive models based on connection, you know, relationships between variables. This is where the humanities, arts, and cultural disciplines come into the picture. Some people forget that universities don't just have science and engineering, but we have these other things, and these people are doing something different. So I hope that this future, the prophetic vision of the future, is about realizing some of these deepest ideals that we share, broadly speaking. Of course, we can debate what those are and who really shares them, but there's something fundamental in the satisfactions of democratic living phrase. And one of the great things about the land grant system is that it is really mud on the boots it's got that dimension to it still. I want a future that keeps that dimension. I don't know how to get there given the dynamics of the funding trends and all of that kind of stuff. And I think part of it has to do with us being able to understand better what exactly is the value of the work. And part of it actually starts with, and this is what I've discovered again in my own work, it starts with letting people tell stories who are already doing all this stuff. Because anything you can dream up of what you could or should be, I can guarantee you is already being done by somebody. So we need to offer, that's why we did the both of those books that David held up, is to give a chance for people to tell those stories, and not because they're perfect or inherently automatically beautiful and wonderful and unproblematic, but because they help us to move from dreamy idealism to practical realities of what's actually happening. So I think there is work to engage in. This is why Imagine America exists, to craft and develop that prophetic vision through, as Dan was saying, through actually practice, through work.
You travel around to different land grants. Is there anything that you would kind of lift up as interesting models for us, particularly anything that people have done to kind of rework how they go at this or restructure the institutions in any way?
You know, there's just amazing things happening. Two women in Oklahoma, Sue Williams and Renee Doherty, both of them in the College of Human Ecology. I think it was Home Economics until very recently. I think they changed it to Human Ecology. These two women from Oklahoma, I went down and gave a talk down there. I foolishly went down there to speak under the title Losing the People's Colleges. And I immediately realized this is a place that has not lost this. Because of meeting women like them. They are organizing hundreds of deliberative forums across the state of Oklahoma, these two fearless women. And they got commissioned by state government to do 100 forums on water use in Oklahoma, like the most explosively controversial issues, fearlessly taking on a task like that. And I did all these interviews with them. In the process, they're interpreting this as, well, this is the land-grant mission. They're interpreting, and so they're bringing in a deliberative dimension and crafting these deliberative forums as a way of building relationships, building community, advancing knowledge and understanding of how people are thinking about issues like this. I could give you a bunch of other examples. I'm also incredibly impressed with what's happening in Alabama. And Joe Sumners, who's the director of the Community and Economic Vitality Institute, and what he's doing with a set of community development extension agents across the state of Alabama. They've done all this work where they've tried all the normal science approach of doing economic development, and mostly it's failed. And, you know, Alabama's a tough place, rural Alabama. And Joe has learned one lesson that he will repeat it every time you talk to him, which is that you can't do economic development without doing community development. So they flipped their work, and now they see economic development not as going in and doing workshops on business retention and development, and that's it, or strategic planning with the county government or local government, but a process of community development that happens through building relationships and having deliberative conversations and trying things.
All right, I promised these folks a break, so I think it's that time. So we'll reconvene at 2:40 in about 11 minutes, but first let's... So before we start into our next session, we have with us today Barbara Allen Diaz, who, as many of you know, is the Vice President for Ag and Natural Resources and has been leading a process within Extension work about trying to rethink about our strategic vision for the organization and reconnect the work we do with public life in more meaningful ways. And so I asked Barbara just to say a few words.
Thank you very much, and I've got to say this first talk was enormously stimulating. Is Scott here still? He's gone out of the room. Here he comes back. So the whole part about narratives and that way of thinking about what we're doing and where we're going made me think of several things now that, you know, there's data, and so there's these kind of narratives, and I want to pass these around because I wasn't going to do this before, but thinking on my feet, we will see how this is. There's these kind of data, and then there's the storytelling narratives, and this first one that the Division of Ag and Natural Resources put out is more of a storytelling. But then me, coming out of the science side, I was wishing for data. And so this second one is hot off the press as of 2 days ago and has data in it. But we're following up with a third one that has economic analysis data. So it's an interesting thing that Scott just brought to our attention, this idea of narratives and how we tell our stories and how that connects with different people in different ways throughout the system, because not everybody understands or connects with what we do in the same ways. So just I want to pass these around. They come back around to me at some time, that'd be great, and if not. But I just want to say that in California, the Division of Ag and Natural Resources and my role in the Division of Ag and Natural Resources is to connect both the Ag Experiment Station, which is housed primarily on the campuses of Davis, Berkeley, and Riverside within the UC system, and Cooperative Extension, which is housed in 57 counties throughout the state, and on the campuses, and in 9 research and extension centers spread throughout the state from the Oregon border to the Mexican border. In our system, our cooperative extension academics are required to do applied research in their local communities in whatever it field that they're in. And there's some 300 cooperative extension academics. In the UC system, the cooperative extension academics are not members of the Academic Senate, which for those of you in the room who are academics, you understand then that that is a different mode of operation than many of the cooperative extension systems throughout the country where the cooperative extension academics are members of the Academic Senate and yet aren't required to do research, okay, in many cases. So our system really believes our cooperative extension academics all either have masters and the recent hires all have PhDs, and they go into the field of cooperative extension because they want to do applied research that does exactly what Scott was talking about. And the rhetoric that's used is work with communities in finding solutions to problems that they're facing across the broadest spectrum of agriculture and natural resources. So it's an interesting set of narratives that hopefully we'll have much more discussion about as we're all evolving. And I guess I want to leave you with that one last kind of thought, too, in the narratives that you brought up, Scott, are that science changes. That's what science is all about. We learn certain, discover, create, learn things about, let's choose my field, the way the environment operates, right? Plant-animal interactions, and we make projections about how things will change given certain activities on the land. We learn from that. And we find out sometimes that what we thought was good or okay really is killing the salmon in the streams or is really causing deformities in birds. And it isn't because science itself was bad or the people that created DDT were bad and thought that they should ruin the earth. by promoting this. It's that we always are learning, and I think that that's a and learning and applying and learning from that so that we can become, more knowledgeable, better stewards of the land, produce more food, help communities across many different levels, from youth development through 4-H programs to production agriculture. And across that whole spectrum, I think that that's one of the roles, one of the major roles of our kind of land grant university that combines the Ag Experiment Station, campus-based research, both theoretical and applied, with cooperative extension. So I'm looking forward to the next talks. You stimulated, Scott, lots of thoughts on in my part that we can move forward with. So thank you very much. And you're going to introduce Rose, right? Okay.
So both of our next two speakers share an interest in this application of research to help solve community problems, but they work in realms that we don't normally think of as part of sort of the same social and political world. Gardening and winemaking may be different poles. You know, if you come onto the Davis campus, you can either come by the Mondavi Institute and the Mondavi Center, if you come one way, or you can come by the student farm and the domes if you come another way. And so one of the things that's obvious when we say the People's University is that there's no single people that we serve. There are many publics. They have many different interests and ideas about what we are and what we should be doing for them and with them. And so anyhow, we'll get two peeks at that today. And we're going to start with Rose, who is one of my great colleagues in Extension. We've been sharing for the last few years the role of strategic initiative leader, she in sustainable food systems, myself in healthy families and communities, working under this new ANR strategic vision. She has a PhD in history from UC Santa Barbara, which was a revelation to me because I knew her as the 4-H Youth Development Advisor from Ventura County, Youth, Family, and Community Advisor, actually, where she's been since 1992. She's also been a Kellogg Food and Society Policy Fellow, and in her work with Kellogg, she's been really advocating on behalf of gardening in all of its forms, home, school, community, now even more as in Extension we're starting to think about urban agriculture as a key constituency for our work. So I wish, she wishes, I had her new book on Victory Gardens and the history of Extension's role with those to wave at you, but we've been keeping her way too busy in her Extension job, and so that's still a few months off, but that just means that all of us get a little bit of a sneak preview today of some of the things that are in that book and Rose's other ideas about where we're going in Extension. So, Rose, very happy to have you here.
I really want to thank you for having me here today. It is such an honor to come to the Davis campus. I always love it, and to have all these people here and to be surrounded by such wonderful speakers. And I really have to give a shout out to Jim Grishup, who's here today, because when I started as a 4-H agent, and our jobs in Extension evolve over the years, Jim Grishup and Dan Desmond were absolutely instrumental in helping me find my way, not only in this gardening, and gardening is the gateway drug to the food system. And my career has evolved in that way, and also really informing my work as an historian. So thank you for coming today, Jim. I really appreciate it. It makes me nervous. Okay. So, a garden for everyone. Everyone in a garden. This is my mission in life. And I'm not smart enough to make that up. I actually stole it from, well, I adapted it from a government publication in World War I. It was the first nationally sponsored curriculum It had to do with school gardening during wartime. It was funded by the Defense Department, and it was called the United States School Garden Army, and a University of California professor was instrumental in writing this curriculum, and the tagline was, "A garden for every child in a garden." And the idea that gardening was vital to national security, and I still think it is. And I think it's a very important thing for all of us to be doing. My mission in life, follow me on Twitter, Victory Grower. And I have to tell you that I have a Mac, so the slides are different than the way that I made them. So we're going to sort of adapt as we go. So it's a really long agenda, but I'm only going to talk to you for 20 minutes. It's going to be really fast. So connecting gardens and agriculture, framing the land-grant mission, which I don't actually have to do because Scott did it so well. So we'll skip that. School and youth gardens, home and community gardens, urban ag, beginning farmers and ranchers, and the investment value of UC in the civic mission. And so my narrative is about this trajectory of UC work, particularly in my community of Ventura, because one of the great things about being an extension advisor in a county is that you get to go become part of the narrative in your community. And you don't dictate the narrative, you become part of it. And it's a call and response. And we call and respond to one another over the years. And we develop a body of work. And the body of gardening work in the community of Ventura with the University of California tracks back 104 years. That's pretty amazing. And I was at the spot yesterday afternoon, and it was really late in the day, and they had locked the gate, and I was going to climb over to take an Instagram photo, and I went, oh, I'll get stuck, I'll fall, I'll miss today, I can't do that. But I'll show you some other pictures. Okay, so connecting gardens and agriculture. People think because I garden, I'm a neophyte. Oh no, you have to understand the roots of the words. So hortus is really just, it's a measure, right? It's a yard. It's the span of a human art. It's basically agriculture on a human scale. And so it's all connected disciplinary-wise. So yes, I am an agriculturist, even though I'm a gardener. Now, the symbolic meaning of gardens, you know, this nation is the New Jerusalem, the Garden of Eden, all the things that we associate with gardening and gardens and as a place for reform and recreation of cultural values, of applied practical skills, and all of the things that gardens bring to us and that UC has informed over the years. Now, the idea of gardens is synthesizing rural and urban interest, and the idea even of the suburbs becoming the middle ground, the middle landscape in American life, sort of between urban and rural, and the convergence of social and cultural interest at this point in time around gardening and urban agriculture and the food system is enormous. It is one of the biggest challenges and opportunities that our University of California has ever faced, and how we respond not only locally to needs and desires, but how we're going to be part of feeding 9 billion people in the world. And some of this is going to occur in gardens. And then the next generation of farmers, a lot of them are gardeners today. So, framing the land grant. You all know about Jefferson and that sort of idea about the yeoman farmer and the idea of how exceptional our nation was because of its agricultural grounding. And I always like to say that we were a nation of farmers at origin, and we are still a nation of farmers at heart. And I do believe that firmly. Now, the Lincoln influence, I don't have to talk a lot about that, but I love Lincoln. And yeah, he did all of this stuff here, Homestead Act, Railroad Act, USDA, the People's Department, and the Morrill Land Grant Act in a period of a few months in 1862. Amazing the implications of all of these things for the American landscape. And, you know, the Hatch and Smith lever, then those amplify things out and connect Americans more strongly to the land and begin applying science and moving it out. And What is really important to me, though, and what frames my life's mission, is something that Lincoln said in 1859 when he was speaking to a group of farmers at the Wisconsin State Fair. Because even today, if you go to the Wisconsin State Fair, you're going to speak to a group of farmers, right? Okay, so what he told them essentially was that as long as every American maintained or had an understanding how to cultivate land, no matter how small the plot, that as long as every American could do that, that we would be free, that we would be free from kings and moneylenders and oppression of all kinds. And so to me, I love Lincoln, and I look at the civic aspect today, the U.S. Department of Agriculture's People's Garden on the National Mall, that on the National Mall, the only federal agency that really has a presence is the U.S. Department of Agriculture and what that says about our nation and what it says about the character of our nation, that we have a vegetable garden on the South Lawn of the White House and our first house and the University of California. We're part of that civic aspect of agriculture and gardening. Now, so Lincoln really informs my work, and we're going to shift right now a little bit into UC's work with school gardens. Raised in myself in the U.S. School Garden Army, this was the World War I program that UC professors were instrumental in delivering, which educated urban and suburban youth, again, to garden during wartime. And look at this poster, this wonderful American flag tie. If you can see, I would point you, except it has a laser, and I've been known to blind people. I get all excited, but see, you can see right here, and then the little American insignia, and this is an urban boy raising food. And the idea, even that over 100 years ago, the U.S. government was concerned about where the next generation of farmers would come from. Where would they come from? And the U.S. government actually thought urban and suburban youth. So, school and youth gardens, national movement, Liberty Hyde Bailey, another one of my heroes. Tip of the iceberg, though, variety of reform efforts with school gardens, the idea of Americanizing immigrants, teaching core curriculum, instilling producer values in urban and rural youth, bridging urban and rural interests, skill building, relief, civic beautification, and reducing urban blight and as a tool for civic engagement. And UC was a national leader in this movement. So my slides are really all messed up. And so I have to tell you that Ernest Babcock was a professor at UC Berkeley, and he wrote much of the library of curriculum that was used to teach kids about agriculture. Okay, so pre-World War I, at the University of California, our campus-based faculty were the first extension advisors and the first extension agents. We had a program called the UC Junior Gardener Program, and it was at Berkeley, and it was in collaboration with the Berkeley School District. And there was an entire garden city, and it wasn't just about teaching kids how to garden. It was a whole idea about teaching kids and engaging kids in democracy. And so the youth had their own governance system, a self-governance system. They had their own farmers market. They had their own bank that was operated by youth. And the University of California enabled this. And today, the sort of way we traject and project this work forward 100 years is we have the Junior Master Gardener Program through 4-H, and we have master gardeners working with school gardens. And we have these books that were developed by the University of California. We still provide those kinds of resources today. And key to this, and I want you to all go home and Google it, it's actually on the Michigan State University website digitized, and it is Circular 46. From the University of California Ag Experiment Station. It is one of the seminal pieces of the school gardening movement in America. And one of the reasons I like it is because this is from my hometown, Ventura. And this is the Ann Street Elementary School. And the kind of hat you see right there, that's a teacher named Zilda Rogers. And she didn't wait for the university to engage her. She engaged the university. And she wrote them about her work, and she asked them questions, and they entered into this iterative dialogue. And when they published their circular about school gardening, they included a picture of her class and all of her comments about the value of school gardening. So where I was yesterday was at the modern site of that school, which was Ann Street Elementary School, is now Lincoln Elementary School, because in the 1930s, we renamed every elementary school Lincoln or Washington, right? Okay, so that's just what we did. Jefferson sometimes, you know. And so I went to that site. So there has been school gardening going on, facilitated and assisted by the University of California for 104 years. And in fact, a couple years ago, we have master gardeners that work there. And it's on the main street in Ventura, and it has been persistent and wonderful for generations. And in World War I, the kids at the school raised 2 tons of potatoes and depressed the local market. So again, so we've already got all of that stuff. And so this work continues, but Zilda Rogers is my hero, and there isn't a public school named after her in Ventura, and I think there should be. So, follow the Pied Piper. This was the United States School Garden Army in World War I. And again, the University of California contributed to the development of this national curriculum. And imagine if we mandated garden-based curriculum today. And instead of race to the top, if we could convince Arne Duncan in Washington, anyone who might be going to Washington, D.C. next week, tell Arne Duncan, not race to the top, race to the crop. Let's teach kids about the food system, right? All right. So home and community gardens in the University of California. So during World War I and World War II, Uncle Sam says garden. And really, just buy my book at the end of the year. And I don't even have to do any more slides. So it says city garden and country garden, farm gardens. And so what the University of California did was help facilitate national goals, which were encouraging local production and consumption. We still do that, reducing the food mile. That term is not from the Leopold Center and that study there. The food mile, this term is from World War I government literature. Food mile, World War I. I really like this stuff. Teach youth about the food system. Woodrow Wilson was concerned about that in World War I. He viewed it as a national security issue. We need 100,000 new farmers a year for the next 10 years in this nation to replace aging farmers. Mobilize and unify Americans around food conservation, and particularly gardening. But again, increasing national security. And in World War II, that took a really different look because it wasn't about the security of the food system in terms of the amount of food and the availability of food. In World War II, the federal government enlisted the University of California and other land grants to help with school, home, and community gardens for something they called nutritional defense. The idea that real national security lay in the health of the nation's citizens. And then out of that impulse, you get things like the National School Lunch Program. And so it's all really interesting stuff. And one of the things that I want to tell you about Ann Street Elementary School, which is Lincoln Elementary School now. So I'm there yesterday, and I'm thinking about Zilda Rogers in 1909, and then I'm thinking about this work that we do there with master gardeners, and then I'm also thinking there's a farm-to-school program in that cafeteria, in that district, which serves 17,000 kids in that district. And so the kids at Lincoln Elementary School, in that wonderful, wonderful farm-to-school program with the salad bar, are producing carrots that are being raised by beginning farmers through a group called the Abundant Table, which has leased land and is learning at the University of California Rec Center in Santa Paula. And the whole idea of the whole circle, that these kids are eating food that's being raised locally by young college-age students who are mostly from urban and suburban areas who are learning how to farm and then feeding back into the community. And What does that say about the University of California and our narrative and how we are present in communities? I think it says wonderful things. And that is what draws me and keeps me in this work, is the prophetic and particular nature of it. Both of those things. So, this is World War II. This is a victory gardener, a California victory gardener, and the University of California was very instrumental in Richmond, California, in thousands of victory gardens there, but a million victory gardens in the state of California in World War II. Make your war garden a garden of victory. The University of California helped out with practical literature. And then, real quickly, I want to say something about this, the girl on the land. So, World War I, Woman's Land Army, women don't have the vote at the national level. But the University of California takes a group of women and has them, students, do an agricultural labor audit one summer to basically say and, you know, confirm that there's going to be an ag labor shortage because we're going to have a draft. And then, in a very wonderful, subversive way for the social good, they have these UC women at the Berkeley campus come down to the farm at Davisville and learn about agriculture, and they become agricultural laborers in service to their nation, in defiance of stereotypes about women's ability to do that kind of work. And they become, in California, the first group of agricultural laborers to win rights, like minimum wage, things like that. They are provided housing by growers in the Central Valley, and they secure rights that elude other laborers for decades. And that is the University of California making that possible, the social good, the advancement. Okay, I'm getting real excited now. I'm going to skip over this because I'm running out of time. Food commandments that the university promoted. Good today. Again, buy local foods. This is the message that the University of California and the federal government put out in World War I. Now, grow your own, be sure. This is something we do right now. Now, in terms of today and this huge effort for school, home, and community gardens, we have 5,000 master gardeners in the state of California today, and the programs are packed. We're now getting renewed interest in the Master Food Preserver program, and the phones are ringing off the hook because you garden people want to learn more about food preservation. I would also like to point out, too, that the FNEP and FISNEP programs that the University of California delivers through cooperative extension, that they also do gardening education. And we also provide gardening education to SNAP recipients, because if you receive SNAP benefits, which are formerly called, you know, the artist formerly called food stamps, you can actually use your SNAP benefits to buy gardening supplies and materials. So we help in cooperative extension. We help SNAP recipients extend their food dollar. We have military garden sites at military bases in our county. And two cooperative extension offices in California will be welcoming Food Corps volunteers next fall. And they'll be working in school gardens and in farm-to-school programs. Now, urban agriculture. In World War II, again, the University of California Cooperative Extension, huge assist in Richmond, California. Today, all over the state, we have urban agriculture going. We have a Grow LA Victory Garden Initiative. We have just funded in our division RFPs that support the development of a UC Urban Ag Portal and other resources, including some CSA research. Ryan Gault, I think Gail Feenstra is involved in these programs. And this is really going to rapidly increase our capacity in this area to serve this growing need and excitement around urban agriculture. Farm to school, we're involved in food policy councils and urban planning so that we can better facilitate the sort of needs and challenges unique to this area. So here's a rooftop garden real quickly. Beginning farmers and ranchers. So this is just about my last point because I know we got to get on. So all of us have probably have heard of Elwood Mead, great UC professor. But most of us think about him as being associated with these huge water projects in the western United States, like Hoover Dam. But actually, one of the most interesting things he did was he worked to develop, post-World War I, two ag settlement colonies. And the idea was to scoop up World War I veterans who might have been infected with Bolshevism while they were in Europe, and to sort of create some pretty ugly ideas about aliens and immigrants, but the idea of assuring farmers and taking veterans and repurposing them to the land and maybe healing them through the land. Now, these colonies were called Durham and Delhi, and that's actually my next writing research project, and they were miserable failures, but that UC model led to the model that was the Resettlement Administration during the New Deal. That was a UC thing. And, you know, today we're serving this clientele beginning in farmers and ranchers all over the state, and some of them are returning veterans. And so that idea, and where our next generation of farmers will come from. So, a cautionary note, and the need for investment in the public service. So one of the things, again, that I believe, I am 52, I have been involved, I've had an intimate relationship with the University of California since I was 18, and actually even younger. I got scooped up first through the 4-H program where the university reached out to me. And then in high school, the university reached out again to me and invited me and other students to come to a summer program on a campus. And my parents had pulled themselves up from very modest beginnings in the rural South through land-grant universities in the GI Bill and had done very well. But I was one of only two students in my high school that went to the University of California. And we were not from a privileged area. And so, you know, our demographics are changing, and this the effects of the GI Bill dynamic, where everyone went to a UC, that's dwindling. And it was pointed out by Scott earlier about this huge shift in GI funding moving from public institutions to private institutions. And it's been a lot of discussion of this at the federal government level and about whether legislation may be required. It has implications for us as the university. And the idea that so many California students are opting to go to University of California, Oregon. You know, this call for distributed educational models and the shifting loyalties. But I looked at it. The other day I was in a meeting with our county's planning manager and, you know, development, you know, planning, all of that stuff. The Farm Bureau director and myself were sitting there in a meeting. All three of us went to the University of California, Santa Barbara, at the same time. And that power and how we need to connect and how we need to understand that the University of California presence in every county is there in the cooperative extension and in the health centers. Ventura County has no UC campus, but right across the street from me, the county hospital is the UCLA teaching hospital for their family residency program, and how we need to push our work out into communities, and it's not just on the campuses, we need to push it out, and that we need to do a better job of doing that, and making the public understand that the university is part of the narrative with them. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Take a quick question for Rose, if there are any, or any comments.
Oh, total tank.
You're off the hook. Tell later.
I'm off the hook.
Oh, you're Michael's
got one. I did have a question. I was watching the Heartland program, and I'm not a plant person, so forgive me. There was a vertical hydroponic systems on top of restaurants, and it was from rooftop to plate is what they were advertising. Do you see those kind of movements of those vertical hydroponics as a...
Yes, and what's amazing is I really quickly flipped over that rooftop garden. They have vertical gardens there, and they did it on the cheap. they took non-toxic pallets and basically retrofitted them with plastic and staples. And that rooftop garden, and actually some places, particularly in Los Angeles, boy, that is really interesting right now. And in the Bay Area, you know, they're doing this whole thing where they're raising food at the top of a building and serving it, preparing the kitchen, serving it right there. And I think that there's a lot of potential. You know, I'm not the expert in that, but I know what I see when I go. And it's amazing to me that 20 years ago, you know, raised beds, and now you're going to the rooftops of restaurants to look at the garden with the chef. It's really pretty exciting.
Great. Thanks again, Rose. So next up, Jim Lapsley, who has a PhD in American history from UC Davis in this case, and both a practicing winemaker himself and an instructor here of many years in the economics of winemaking, long career in university extension here, the other extension. And he is the author of this wonderfully titled book, Bottled Poetry. Not only wonderfully titled, but one of the most beautiful book covers I've ever seen. So you can come up, take a peek later. That is a story about Napa Valley winemaking, and in particular about the connection of UC Davis to the Napa Valley. And he's kind of the foremost storyteller of that relationship, and going to share maybe a little piece of that with us this afternoon. So thanks.
Well, thank you, David. It is an honor to be asked to do this, and I'd like to thank three people first of all. Martin Kenney, about a year and a half ago, approached me. He's co-editing a book that's trying to examine through a series of chapters interactions of different UC campuses with the economic development of the region. Most of these are fairly high-tech, and he wanted to do something for Davis, and he thought that the Napa Valley was pretty neat, and he asked me to write the chapter. So what I'm drawing out of here is a very small part of that chapter. It's kind of a case study using some science. Second person is David and the group for asking me to present this. And third, Barbara, is she still here? Yeah. I'm working here, I'm retired, and I'm working 30% time with the Agricultural Issues Center. And in time of budget cuts, she actually continued to get some funding for AIC, and I very much appreciate having a desk, so thank you. The title is We Are Both Hosts. I think that what Rose gave us was more of narrative three, and I really like the notion of narrative, Scott. And this is going to seem on the face of it narrative one, technology transfer, and we do it very well. There's going to be one slide that's definitely narrative two, ecological collapse and disaster. And then, but I think that the subtext really is more this, the narrative three. And the notion of we are both hosts is that Davis faculty like to do science. They need to do it within a context, and that context comes back through the students. And it's an iterative group, and I think that that's kind of the message I want to leave. So how many of you have been to Napa? Yeah, okay. So you've all seen this sign. It was put up in the 1950s by the Napa Valley Vintners, the owner group. It was a much smaller group at the time when they put it up. And it says, welcome to this world-famous wine-growing region. When they put it up in 1950, that was aspirational. Okay, it wasn't world-famous. However, it has become world-famous. And so let's start with a few facts about Napa. So Napa has about 45,000 acres. There's about 550,000 acres of wine grapes in California. So it's about 8%. Napa has a lower yield. It has about 4% of the total yield of grapes, and it has about 25% of the income. If we look at numbers beyond grapes, and these numbers in the blue chart, or the blue bars, are millions of dollars. I looked at the 2012. In 2012, it went down from 540 down to 453. Those are in five-year increments. 2012, it was back up to 650 million. And it's about, again, 25%. Once we turn this into wine, and it gets out in the sold, because Napa wine's expensive wine, $4.4 billion. And then there's these residual things to the community called tourism. and it's an estimate there of $1 billion. Now, this is by some other economist, and I just use those numbers, but I think they're representative. The other thing we can see here is that this line is the percent, and we're getting up to 98%, of all agricultural income in Napa County. So clearly it's a monocrop. What's that? It's a one crop, one industry. And it wasn't always the case. It really starts growing in the 1960s and grows a lot in the 1980s and 1990s, which is the period I'm going to be talking about. So why is Napa so dominant? The first is environment, and I'm not here to teach you about viticulture, but environment really is important. Environment affects the qualities or the attributes of the grapes, which in turn affect the wine. The intensity, the flavors, the acidity, the color are all enhanced. Let's just say that Napa is a wonderful place to grow grapes in general and an excellent place to grow Cabernet Sauvignon. Another thing is the owners. The owners early on and much later have become a group of people. They're generally quite rich. Some of them bring in revenue into Napa. But what they're trying to do is they're trying to make the best wine in the world. They're willing to put in funds for that, so they're actually pushing for that. So you can have a great environment and not have anybody say, yeah, we're just going to make some good wine. You make good wine in Napa. If you want to really make excellent wine, you have to put in these other inputs. And that brings the third part, the adoption of science, which is really the technology part, the narrative one. So in this case study, what I want to do is to look at the reciprocal and symbiotic interaction between UC Davis, mostly my department of viticulture and enology, but certainly other departments within UC Davis, and the Napa wine and grape industry, looking at teaching, research, extension, both extensions, cooperative and university. And then I'm going to use canopy management, a type of viticultural research that occurred in the 1980s and is going on, as the specific case study. Are there other studies, other examples I could use? Yes. I have 15 minutes. So what happened? During the 1980s, UC Davis researchers, primarily Dr. Mark Cleaver, who's now retired, but some others as well, started working in the Napa Valley vineyards to discover how the manipulation of the canopy, the leaves and the structure of the vines and the way the vines were grown, how that would affect the constituent parts in the grapes. Then cooperative and university extension disseminated the information, and as I'm going to point out, primarily to UCD graduates, and another slide I'm going to show you in a moment, that UCD graduates overwhelmingly the winemakers and grape growers in the Napa Valley. And then this is the black part, the collapse of the AXR rootstock, which had been advocated by UC Davis for many years in the late 1980s, actually turns out to be a blessing in disguise, although very expensive for a lot of people. It necessitates the replanting, which then allows the Napa Valley to be the first really in Northern California to adopt these new ideas. So, why Napa? On the right, we see a picture of the Oakville Experiment Station, and I think there's several reasons. First of all, if you're a faculty member here in Davis and you want to study the fine wine industry, that means you have to go to a cooler area, and Napa's the closest one to get to. It's about an hour away, hour to an hour and a half, depending upon where you're going in the Napa Valley. There has been, and there and continues to be, a long history of cooperation between the Napa Valley and the University of California, and that goes back to before Davis was created. I mean, I'm currently looking at the wine boom of the 1880s, and there was interaction at that point between Hilgard and Berkeley and the Napa growers. But again, getting back to the notion of the growers also taking responsibility and thinking back about that sign, following at the end of World War II, they looked and they said, gee, there's a 20-acre property that's right adjacent to what's now the Mondavi Winery. It's on Oakville Grade, just at the base of the grade. There's a 20-acre property there that's owned by USDA. It was used for rootstock trials in 1906, and it's been vacant for quite a while. We should try and get our congressman to give this land to the University of California. And they tried, and they tried, and they tried, and they got very frustrated. And so what did they do? They went out and bought 20 acres in 1947 on the south side of Oakville. Again, and this is about the most, if you wanted to go buy land to grow Cabernet grapes, this is the best part you could possibly ever do. So in 1947, they've got 20 acres. We call it the South Vineyard, and it was given to the University of California. And then in 1954, they were able to get the USDA to give the land. Actually, it's a very long-term lease. We couldn't sell it. If we ever gave it up, it would go back to USDA. So we now have 40 acres there. And this is by 1954. And this we refer to it collectively as the Oakville Experimental Vineyard. So this was a resource for faculty members, especially for viticulturists. Dr. Mark Cleaver decided he was going to start a trial at Oakville. And this is Mark on the right, Carlos Tizio, who was one of his master's students and is a leader in viticulture now in Argentina, is just by him. This, unfortunately, I wasn't able to find a picture actually at the actual vineyard, so this is just a vineyard shot. But what he decided he would do is he would plant 5 acres of Cabernet, so that's essentially a quarter of the South Vineyard into Cabernet, and he was going to try 2 different trellis systems, ways of opening up the canopy to light penetration, 3 different row spacings, and 5 different pruning, which is essentially looking at different levels of yield. And any of you who have done, I know there are actual agricultural scientists out there, start looking at this and you go, how many variables did I really want here? There are a lot of variables here. So he started that in 1980. And I should also say that the experiment station had also been kind of a center for interaction between viticulturists in the Napa Valley and the cooperative extension. I'll come back to that in a moment. So what he ended up doing after the study, and I'm jumping further ahead, is it turns out here on the left, you can see this kind of bush. This was referred to as the California sprawl. You had this one wire, you allowed the canes to come down, it shaded the fruit, and it was difficult to pick. And we're in Napa, so did it make good wine? Yes. Did it maximize the possibility? No. So what his study showed was that by opening up the canopy, we can increase berry color, we can have earlier ripening, which, by the way, gets now translated into higher sugar, lower the pH, so you have higher acid. It reduces the vegetal green bean aromas that are associated with shaded canopy in Cabernet. You have higher tannin levels, which the winemakers can then play with to get more extraction, and it reduced rot. All around, a really good thing. So while Cleaver was putting these in, some other viticulturists came and they said, gee, we see you're putting in a trial. He goes, yeah. Why are you putting it here? Well, because we have the space. We'd like to cooperate with you and have you do some at our various vineyards. And we can do maybe something not quite so, not so many variables, and we can look at individual things. And not only that, we'll make the wine out of it, and we can taste it, and we can see how it really turns into wine. And so in 1982, the North Coast Viticultural Research Group was formed of 8 wineries, the 6 of which, the top 6, are all Napa wineries. I just want to point that out. And then the other 2 on the bottom are from Sonoma. But if you notice this, Bill Fries, later on at Mondavi, PhD in biochemistry from UCD. Roland Wilkinson, BS from UCD. Tucker Catlin, BS in fermentation science. Bob Steinauer, master's in Fresno State in viticulture. Will Nord, master's in actually vocational agriculture, but he was the head of viticulture for Domaine Chandon. Ed Weber, both a bachelor's of science and a master's of science from UCD in Department of Viticulture and Enology. He later becomes a farm advisor. Zelma Long, very well known in the industry and actually now married to Phil, BS in Oregon State. She didn't finish her master's at Davis because Mondavi just hired her away, but she did work here. And then Rob Davis, the leader at Jordan, BS UCD. The point that I'm trying to point here is that these were all former students that had been trained here at Davis. And so this is interaction that's occurring with faculty. And so this slide here, these are the numbers of wineries increasing. And so this is statewide, and this is in Napa. New wineries need people with technical expertise to run them. They need winemakers, and they need viticulturists. And so there was a huge demand in this period, and there still is, for trained technical people. And it was Davis that was supplying that. Over here is a different study, and again, I want to thank Mark Kinney for this because he was really the one who started doing this. But what we did is we looked at 231 Napa wineries, their websites, just didn't include everything, but trying to see where are these winemakers from? Well, 180 claimed that they were from UC Davis. because I think what they said is they studied at UC Davis. The next was University of Bordeaux and then Fresno. Again, an incredible domination. And I think that this is one of the things we forget when we're looking at the land-grant institution, is that teaching is also a very, very important part of this. And here we teach, especially our master's students, to be scientists and to learn how to do their own experiments because we know that they're going to have to solve things in their own contexts. So this is the bad slide. In 1983, phylloxera, which is a root louse that eats vinifera rootstocks, was found in the Napa Valley. There had been a huge boom in the 1970s, so there was a vast level of planting in the North Coast in the 1970s. There was a need for rootstock because we knew from earlier phylloxera issues that we had to have a rootstock that was resistant. AXR was a rootstock. It stands for Aramon, which is a grape variety, vinifera variety crossed with Rupestris, which is a different non-vinifera. This was a variety that had been created by a Frenchman, Professor Gazin, in the 1880s. It was rejected for as not having sufficient phylloxera resistance. However, because of the vinifera parentage, it took grafts very well, and it also imparted vigor, so you got large crops. And we had, not in one continuous trial, but going back to that 1907 trial, that the rootstocks at the Oakville Station, we had well over 70 years' worth of data showing that AXR didn't fail. So AXR was used in the 1970s as the major rootstock. It starts to fail, and by 1990, they're having to replant the Napa Valley. It was very expensive, and there were some wineries and vineyards that went out of business because of that. And UC Davis got a lot of bad rap on that. And this would be the second narrative. This is the narrative of scientists gone crazy with hubris and planting a monocrop and not really and ignoring things. Well, there's some truth to that. But the result is that because of that replanting, all these vineyards were replanted at least 15 years earlier than they normally would have been, which meant that in the replanting, they could adopt all these new ideas. Not only that, the viticulturists in the Napa Valley were thinking about this and could actually do their own trials. So the main way this got through was through cooperative extension and university extension. The farm advisors have long played a key role in the Napa Valley in viticulture. The first position was in 1951 with Jim Leiter. His brother, Lloyd Leiter, was a professor in the department. Keith Bowers, who was the original Oakville Extension station manager, later became the second farm advisor when Jim retired. Ed Weber, remember, he was a member of that technological group. He had come back and gotten a master's when he'd been working at Phelps. When Keith Bowers retired, Ed became the extension person, and we can see him there kind of one-on-one. And then with Ed's untimely death, Monica Cooper, has a PhD in entomology, is now the current viticulturist. Although they oftentimes worked one-on-one, Keith Bowers created a Napa Valley technical group where they got together once a month and they had Davis faculty, or they reported on their own studies and they shared information. And again, this is one of the things about community, kind of building this forward. And meanwhile, I was working at University Extension, and during this period, University Extension partnered with Viticulture and Enology and the farm advisors to put together a series of formal classes, 1 day, 2 day, 3 day short courses on a variety of topics. And I went back and looked at, just trying to get a sense of the impact, I went back and looked at enrollments. And we were generally getting about 1,000 enrollments in viticulture every year, and roughly 20% of that was coming from the Napa Valley. Again, disproportional, although it's close, so they could come here, but disproportional from the amount of acres that they had. So, a conclusion? Sure. Through teaching, research, and extension, Davis has had a profound impact on California and the California grape wine industry. I think that's clear. I'm just looking at canopy management. That's all the time that I had to really give as an example. There are several others that I could give you, both in grape growing and in winemaking. But what I see here is that the industry's problems and questions in-depth funding UC research, which gets back to this notion of that we are both hosts. John Williams got his master's from here. He's the owner of Frog's Leap Winery. He's kind of a holistic individual. And when I was interviewing him for the study, he said, we're both hosts. It wasn't just one way of Davis telling us what to do. We were telling Davis what we needed to do, and we were cooperating with them in getting that information. So I think that that takes us to the narrative three, and I want to conclude with this slide, which I think is really a notion of community. This is, on the left, is UC Davis in the 1940s, and on the right is our student classroom, our viticulture, our new winery, which was funded entirely with industry money. No UC, no state money. And if you haven't come by and seen it, I think you should. It's really beautiful. So thank you very much. I hope that this case study, which is very specific, somehow helps us think about the land-grant mission.
Mark, you had a question? Yeah, so I got in touch with Jim. The Office of the President funded us to do a book on the various interactions between UC campuses. Everything else is high tech. And I thought of Davis, and I was looking around, I said, I'm going to do this research, and then somebody said, well, Jim has already done it. Now I go around the country describing my book of these interactions between university and industry, and everybody wants Jim's chapter, and not the other ones.
They haven't read it yet, though.
But I'm plugging the book. You may not care about high tech, electronics and all these other things, but this is an absolutely great illustration of how the University of California, across a whole set of industries, has had this interaction going both ways, learning from industries, from firms out there, and also simultaneously transmitting information. And so I think Davis is really, at the end of this book, I think people are going to see exactly how powerful Davis has been in one cluster, one industry area. So I think it's a good book. You'll need to read the book for Jim's chapter. It's really worth it.
Yeah. I'm an extension specialist here at UC Davis and worked for a number of years, a decade. In this area. And I have to say that repeatedly, over time, year after year, some of the most positive and powerful interactions that I have are in one-to-one with farmers and with industry group folks on their place where you actually sit and listen. And I think will always be true. And I just would like to say that as we think forward to a high-tech future, that should never be lost.
I agree with you. Let me make it. We were talking about this at lunch, and the real question is, how do we afford that? It's one-on-one is very expensive. It's also very valuable, and I think we're going to see more and more. What happened in the Napa Valley, I'm talking about, of course, was that there were groups that were getting together to talk about things. But there was still Ed Weber and before him Leiter were out there, and Keith Bowers were out talking with people individually, one-to-one, and I could give you lots of examples. But it's going to be very difficult. Yeah. Yeah, Barbara.
So as we just said, how can we not afford it?
Yeah.
Because once again, you showed an example of that negative narrative, which I was trying to articulate, but maybe not so well. And the positive and really forward-thinking part is we learn from that negative narrative, and we learn because science and education and learning in that two-way street was still going on, so that when we recognize that we could move forward with alternative solutions based on the best science available at the time.
Yeah, I think we all value that face-to-face interaction, and there's no substitute for it. But there's also a question of how we frame that. Mm-hmm. And the studies that Keith Warner did about the biologically integrated farming systems in California that WorkSERA did was, these are face-to-face, but they're actually network interactions, which I think is a common feature of high-tech as well. And so it suggests a different kind of a replication model that actually could be quite powerful in terms of network externalities, combination of
personal relationships and communication technology.
May I tell you, do that, and then I want to tell a story, and then we'll be done. Because the narratives are good.
Okay. Well, just the observation that we're talking about a system, a land grant system. And Jim has done a great job in showing the impact of teaching and how that is an information delivery. And the other, the point I want to make, however, is that in extension, it has been described as technology transfer, which it is, but it also represents a tremendous feedback mechanism. That is, it brings back to the researcher, who may not have the chance to go out into the field because of the many responsibilities they have for publishing and teaching and so forth. But the extension person then can come back and say, well, we've had a problem here that we don't understand. Can you help us? And then a research project's developed. So it really is a system, and it's not just one way. It's a two-way street.
I agree. Well, the four pictures that you showed at the start, we're building a bridge, and bridges, people go both ways. I want to tell just a really quick story, and because I know we want to take a break. In 1976, there was a tasting. Most of you probably know the Steven Spear tasting, the bicentennial tasting in Paris, where, quote-unquote, California wines, most of which were Napa wines, beat the French wines. Although if you do a statistical analysis, it was a tie, and that was good enough. But the number one in this one unreplicated tasting was a Cabernet and a Chardonnay, both from the Napa Valley. The Cabernet was Warren Winiarski's down in the Stag's Leap area. Warren had settled in the Stag's Leap area because he had had a wine that was from the Fay Vineyard that was local right by from Cabernet that he was really impressed with. The reason that Nathan Fay had planted there was that it was Leiter had said, you know, you might want to plant Cabernet here. And all the locals said, no, it's too cold. And Leiter said, I think it'll do pretty well. And he did. And so then, so Fay said, yeah, I will plant some. And he said, but where can I get some budwood? He said, oh, well, you can get that from the Martha's Vineyard that Joe Heitz had made some wonderful Cabernet from over near our Oakville Experiment Station. So they went and they got budwood from them. I mean, this was a sharing thing. And then the Martha's Vineyard, the manager says, yeah, you know, we got all our budwood right across the fence from the Oak and got it out of the Oakville Station. It's a nice way of looking how one-on-one actions do have existence. Thank you.
So we'll take 10 minutes and come back for Larry Bush batting cleanup.
Thank you all for your continuing energy here, and I'll just remind you, after our final speaker, we're going to have a chance to bring all the speakers back up, and you know, depending upon how much energy we've got, we'll have some time for some group conversation at that point. I've asked Bill Lacey to introduce our final speaker. Bill, you know, is our Vice Provost for University Outreach and International Programs, and longtime associate of Larry Bush. So, Bill.
Thanks, Dave. I've known Larry Bush now for almost 40 years. And so, in the spirit of telling tales and stories and narratives, I will not do that today. No, it is my real distinct pleasure. Larry has been described as a Renaissance man. The range of experiences and the depth of his knowledge across so many fields has really benefited many of us for decades now. Started with Peace Corps experiences, or didn't start with a Peace Corps experience, but included Peace Corps experiences in West Africa, the VISTA programs in the South. But his topics, think about the topics that Larry's addressed in his various books. The organization and structure of agricultural and agricultural research, the globalization of agriculture, agricultural biotechnology, the commercialization of knowledge. How do we democratize science in an era of expert and private knowledge? So he's looked at and written a book on the Berkeley-Syngenta relationship. He has written books on marketing, food security in the United States, as well as the broader food system. You get a reflection of how he's going to come at this by reading the titles. What kinds of stories is Larry going to tell you? Well, he tells you a little bit about that in the titles of his books, and I'll just share with you a few of those titles. One, Science, Agriculture, and the Politics of Research. And Charlie actually asked Larry to testify against the California Rural Legal Assistance Group many, many years ago. But then again, the California Rural Legal Assistance Group also asked him to testify on behalf of them as well. Some of the other titles of the books, Plants, Power, and Profit, the Social, Economic, and Ethical Consequences of the New Biotechnologies, gives you another insight into the story that Larry will tell around those topics. From Columbus to ConAgra, the Globalization of Agriculture, Universities in the Age of Corporate Science, the UC Berkeley Novartis. It wasn't Syngenta, it was Novartis, sorry. The Novartis country. Pardon?
It became Syngenta.
Yes, yes. I was just getting ahead of the story a bit. And his most recent book focuses on standards. And this takes us into a whole new realm because standards touch on every aspect of our life. His new book, Standards, Recipes for Reality, by MIT Press, concludes a very, very broad and very diverse journey. So I'm looking forward to your comments. Thanks, Larry.
Thank you very much. A pleasure to be here. I should begin by noting that Bill is being unnecessarily modest since he was co-author of a significant number of those books that he just listed. And hence, obviously, anything that was good about them was mine. Anything that was bad, we have to blame on Bill. Okay. Well, that's good. Something is mysteriously showing up on my screen here that I don't need. Okay, there we go. Well, what I want to do today, oh, for crying out loud. My computer has decided to pop all sorts of unnecessary notes up on me. There we go. So what I want to do today is to first talk about neoliberalism, and I'll explain in a minute what I mean by that. Then I want to talk about its consequences for administration, for education, for research, and for extension and outreach. Then I'm going to very briefly note some of the crises that you're all well aware that we currently face. I'm going to ask what can be done. I'm going to make some pretty outrageous and perhaps wrong proposals for change. You can be the judge of that. And I'm going to then conclude with some suggestions that sort of try to wrap this all up. So let's begin by asking this question. What am I talking about when I'm talking about neoliberalism? And what I'm talking about is that since the collapse of the Soviet bloc, governments have embraced markets. Markets are viewed almost universally as the solution to all political and economic problems and as the primary source of individual liberty, based on work by people like Howard Becker, Milton Friedman, and F.A. Hayek, among many, many others. Now, this is a relatively new phenomenon over the last, say, 50 to 70 years, but particularly since the collapse of the Soviet Union. And what these folks self-define themselves as is that a transformation, all institutions should be transformed into markets or market-like institutions, or at the very least, competitions. And all persons at the same time should be transformed into competitive, entrepreneurial, risk-taking individuals for whom life is largely a matter of winning. Now, footnote here. This is a broad brush presentation, and I'm going to jump over lots of nuances that if I had 4 or 5 hours, and I doubt any of you would want to stay here that long, if I had 4 or 5 hours, I might mention those. So do understand as I say this that I am making this broad brush presentation. Now, there's also a confusion here, and that is in the U.S. there are two completely different uses of the word liberal. One is adhering to the left end of the political agenda, so we talk about liberals versus conservatives, and the other is somebody who promotes free trade, markets, and liberty in contrast to direct government regulation. And it's the second meaning that I want to focus on today. Now, the peculiar thing about neoliberalism is that, as Phil Murawski, an economist at Notre Dame, has noted, it's best understood as a thought collective. That is to say, There's no rigid adherence to some very clearly stated doctrine. Everybody doesn't bow down to Hayek or Friedman or Becker every morning and say, yes, you know, let's light a candle there or burn some incense or something like that. Nothing like that. But at the same time, neoliberalism is a kind of social movement that has been extraordinarily effective in transforming the world over roughly the last half century. It's been promoted by annual debates at the Mont-Pelerin Society. You can go online, search them, and read what goes on at these debates. It's publicly available. And it's been performed very differently in different places and different times. So neoliberalism in the United States is not what it is in Britain, is not what it is in France, certainly isn't what it is in Chile, and certainly isn't what it is in Iraq. But all that said, neoliberals argue that markets and competitions are the best way to organize institutions. They reject the notion of laissez-faire. No, states are there to promote markets and institutions. We need to turn states around from staying away from the market, letting the market do its thing, to actively promoting it. And at the same time, neoliberals are very interested in reconstructing selves as entrepreneurial, autonomous, and risk-taking. And individual choice, as anybody who lives in American society knows, is promoted almost ad nauseum. The neoliberals have, I would argue, succeeded in recasting the land-grant universities, and for that matter, most universities, over the last several decades. And that has consequences in the four domains that I mentioned a moment ago. So let me start off. Oddly enough, I'm going to start off with administration. I hope the provost doesn't start throwing tomatoes at me. What's happened in administration? Well, we've seen both a changing roles of administrators and a rather significant increase in the number of administrators. Now, there's some debate over how do you define who's an administrator, who's not, but the data that come up give generally roughly a 60% increase in the number of administrators between 1993 and 2009, and only about, this is about 10 times faster than the growth in the number of tenured faculty. And the question then becomes, why? Now, some people say, well, this is because, after all, administrators are in control. If you need another administrator, just hire one. Whereas if you're on the faculty, you've got to make the case to the administrators to hire them. Well, that might be true a little bit, but frankly, I don't buy that. What I would argue is that, first of all, there's been an explosion of new unfunded mandates, crime reports, the books that people order, the salaries of graduates, sexual harassment. We can go on and you could list pages of new regulations. In addition, there's been the adoption, and I would argue this is either knowingly or unknowingly, but there's been the widespread adoption and pressure from politicians to do this, to adopt what's known as new public management, which is, according to one observer, a combination of free market rhetoric and intensive management control practices. And what NPM does is involve the use of audits of all kinds to control actions. And states and federal government have increased their mandates for universities. They've increased the cost of collecting and analyzing, but the cost of collecting and analyzing these data with all these audits is essentially rarely considered. So you have enormous amounts of auditing going on, and of faculty, auditing of students, auditing of extension staff, auditing of everybody on the university faculty and staff, auditing of just about anybody. And of course, this is not unique to universities, right? You see this across the board, all institutions. In addition, we come from a tradition in which most managers, especially top managers, were academics, to finding more and more people in top management positions at universities who are formal administrators. That is to say, they're people who developed their careers as administrators and spend most of their careers in administration and maybe have never been in the classroom. We see a gradual slide, I would argue, of administrators as protectors of faculty from a whole variety of outside influences, including defending academic freedom, among other things, not to say people don't do that, towards managers of faculty. And this, again, I would argue it's not because administrators have some evil intentions here. It's because much of this has been forced on administrators, or administrators have succumbed to it, seeing, well, that's not too unreasonable. There's also been this creation of administrative careers and enormous top salary growth among administrators. So, for example, the presidents of both Ohio State and Texas A&M universities, two land grants, have total compensation that's now in the neighborhood of $2 million a year. And I'd have to ask, why? I'm not going to answer that question, but okay. In addition to that, we've seen university advertising and marketing grow at a rather fast pace. It's not at all uncommon these days to have marketing offices. And these use data from various ranking organizations and promote these. The strangest one I've ever seen was in an airport, I believe it was in Dallas, that said such and such a school was ranked 21st in its category. Why would you advertise that? I have no idea. Anyway. But one of the problems with these things, of course, the ratings themselves, if you get a good rating, my gosh, you put it up on the webpage. If you get a bad rating, you say, well, you know, this rating system really is broken. It doesn't work right. Okay? And the fact is, most of these rating systems are rather sloppy. They include enormous amounts of poor quality data. They rate things on which universities don't really have any particular influence on, and so on and so forth. And finally, of course, the flip side of all this is a vast growth in the number of adjunct faculty who are often poorly paid, have insecure jobs, and make up a growing proportion of the faculty just about everywhere. So we've also seen, of course, a change in university support. State funds have declined, tuition has gone up, public and private grants everybody's pushing for, although the numbers, obviously not everybody can participate in what is essentially an almost static pie. And of course, the pressure to create donations, to create development offices that promote all sorts of things, please donate for X, Y, and Z. We'll name, I don't know, the water fountain out there in the hall after you if you'll support it, is not entirely uncommon. We also see the development, and this comes back to new public management, of thinking of universities in numerical terms. Quantitative data to govern universities. Now note, the corporate sector is doing the same thing and has also had some fiascos as a result of this use of quantitative data. The problem is that the numbers for this quantitative stuff almost always come from convenience samples. That is to say, gee, we have these data laying around. Supermarkets, for example, have used loyalty cards for years, right? Well, what's a loyalty card? It's a convenience sample. People walked into the store and signed up for one of these things, okay? The catch, of course, is that they may or may not be representative of the population that you're trying to manage. And the questions involved, the data to collect, may or may not be the relevant data, but those are the data you have. And they appear incredibly concrete, but they're indeed very, very abstract. So, for example, it's easy to count publications. It's much more difficult to measure the import of those publications. Similarly, measuring the size of a bacterial culture, say we have a culture in a petri dish, and we put it in the dish and we want to see how fast it grows, and so once a day at the same time we measure the size of the culture. Well, it has very little effect on its growth to do that. By contrast, the moment that you put metrics in place, they change human behavior. People are very good at that. In fact, somebody's coined this notion of Goodhart's law, that when a measure becomes a target, it's no longer a reliable measure. We also have the problem of errors. That is to say, data that are analyzed in the manner I'm describing here are quite different from the kind of results one gets when one has a scientific laboratory. Because in the scientific laboratory, we decide what kind of data we're going to collect. We collect it in a manner that attempts to produce something which is at least, shall we say, generalizable to some population, and never do it from just what happens to be conveniently available. Or at least we try not to do it from that. And then finally, measures are never an adequate substitute for judgment. The measure seems to allow you to get away from judgment, but in fact it doesn't. You still have to make a judgment. And the judgment then is going to be biased. It's always going to be biased, but it's going to be biased based on how good those data are that are being used to make the judgment. So let's start with education then. Now, in education, I think the main thing here is shifting from a public good to a private good. As most of you know, student debt is now more than $1 trillion. It's more than total consumer debt, which is astoundingly high. And at the same time, we have students, certainly not all of them, but a very significant portion of the student body working 30 to 40 hours a week in order to keep that debt load down. And this, not surprisingly, has a direct effect on student performance. in fact, a whole series of effects on student performance. We've moved from public support of our institutions of higher education to individual support. And this is part of this neoliberalizing, if you wish, of higher education. It's your responsibility to take charge of this, even if it winds up leaving you with several $100,000 in debt. We've seen also, as a result of this, because tuition has gone up, a rise in the number of for-profit competition schools that are out there. Somebody mentioned the University of Phoenix. It's one of the examples, although it's having some difficulties now. It's closing down a whole bunch of campuses. What's interesting about these for-profit institutions is that they're heavily dependent on government grants. The reason all those military folks went there is because they got subsidized to go there, not because they woke up one morning and said, oh, wow, the University of Phoenix, that's the place to go. They have very poor records of recruitment and placement. We've also seen the creation of these MOOCs, these massive open online courses. And if really this were to come into play, and I'm skeptical, let's say, about whether it will, what is problematic about this is it's least likely to help the most poorly prepared students. MOOCs are great if you're already well prepared and motivated and ready to go. This is wonderful. But if you're not motivated and you don't have much preparation, it's like listening to gibberish. And on top of that, there's no opportunity in most of these situations to actually have any kind of inquiry or discussion with the people who are producing them. We've also seen a decline in foreign language instruction, which is ironic. As we get more and more globalized, we wind up abolishing foreign language requirements or saying, well, you can replace it with some computer courses, as if somehow these things were the same. And the result, of course, is students being more likely to misunderstand those from other cultures and less likely to understand how language creates the world in which we're in. I drove a whole bunch of undergraduates in a science and tech class crazy last semester when I asked them to explain a whole set of concepts and put them in order and how all of this worked. And what they were astounded to discover was that, of course, they disagreed on what those categories meant, even though they all knew what the categories were. And so there was this enormous debate that took place, mostly among undergraduates in the sciences and engineering, and they were astounded. It was like, well, I thought, you know, if it's a tree out there, then it's a tree. Isn't that it? Isn't there anything else to discuss? Isn't that thing naturally a tree? Well, of course, it's not. Moreover, we've seen education as being defined solely in terms of salary maximization. And a couple of examples here. University of Tennessee now mandates that first-year salaries of graduates of all Tennessee institutions be posted online. The average salary, not the individual salaries, but the average salary. There are real problems with the quality of the data because only people who remain in Tennessee get posted, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But nevertheless, it's saying what counts here is how much money you make. And of course, it also assumes first-year salary is some good predictor of long-term salary, which it's not. Texas A&M has evaluated its faculty based on how much revenue they bring in and actually gave every single faculty member a scorecard that says you cost the university this much in salary and you brought in this much money. I don't know what to say about that. We've seen a growth in testing for knowledge and particularly in standardized multiple choice type tests, which in part are the result of a decline in the number of teaching assistants. If I've got a class of 300, it's going to be darn difficult for me to read 310-page or 15-page essays, not within a reasonable period of time, anyway. Moreover, there's pressure building for national standardized tests for university students, which are much like those already given in elementary school. And I would argue that if this is done, it will drastically reduce the creativity of the university curriculum. Also, we've discovered that students now spend half as much time studying as they did in the 1960s. 32%, according to one study, didn't take a single course that required more than reading 40 pages a week. Half did not require any course that required writing more than 20 pages over the course of a semester. These are national studies of four-year and research universities, with not much distinction, as I understand it, between the two groups. Whoops. We've also seen a dumbing down of higher education. In that I certainly know from my own experience that I now get upper division and even graduate students who cannot write a straight sentence. And of course, the reason for that is they never had to write a straight sentence. They didn't even have to write a crooked sentence, for that matter. And perhaps worst of all, we see a rise in plagiarism, an astounding rise in plagiarism. And let me just give you one example here. This is a website You can go and look it up, lastzone.com. That advertises, note what it says over there on the slide here, if you recognize some of your teachers in this photo, you will need our help. Now, it's worse than that. It's worse than that because here's directly off the website. I made it a little larger so you could read it. I won't read it out loud. You can read it yourselves. And from what I can find out about this outfit, and this is, by the way, not just a single... No, that's right. They can't even write a straight sentence on their website. Although that might be good because that shows that they're not perfect, which will go well in the paper. Right? I mean, the student who writes the perfect paper, we're all suspicious of. One that has a few errors of grammar or spelling, well, that makes more sense. Okay? But these are international organizations. That is to say, the people who work for them are distributed around the world. Many of them are not based in the United States, and hence there's absolutely no way you can get to them through U.S. courts, for example. And there are literally dozens of these organizations. And you can be assured that some of your students are using these services just as some of my students are using these services. So let's move on to research. The first thing that's been done, of course, is counting publications. And one thing that's wonderful about this doesn't require too much work. Anybody can count publications. However, in some fields, it's much easier to divide research into small pieces than it is in others. So, for example, if I'm doing laboratory soil science, and I have various size marbles in a tank and I want to look at water flow, I can do a different experiment once a week and publish them all as separate experiments. In other fields, of course, this is much, much more difficult to do. Okay? But nevertheless, in the fields in which it's easy to do, there's tremendous pressure to increase the number of publications. Now, moreover, there's been a vast growth in the number of journals, largely as a result of this, which means that there's most likely a home for virtually any paper. If you're willing to take the time and send it to enough journals, you will probably find one that will do it. So what's been happening instead? Well, let's rank the journals and find someone who publishes in highly ranked journals. So, all right, that's one option. The other is, of course, counting citations. And the catch here is that, of course, in principle, authors have little control over the number of citations they receive. Now, of course, admittedly, you can cite yourself, but unless you write 500 papers a year, you're not going to get 500 citations out of it, right? But here again, those working in small fields with relatively few researchers, all other things being equal, are far more likely to be cited than those working in large fields, whether the quality of the paper is good or bad. Moreover, you can be cited for reasons that have absolutely nothing to do with the quality of your research. And I give the example here of Hwang Woo-suk, the Korean researcher who was cited, according to Science Citation Index last week, 388 times his paper in Science was cited, almost entirely because he produced fraudulent claims about stem cells. But he's in there, 388 cites to one paper. Not bad. Moreover, none of this pays any attention to the fact that citing is about the article's rhetoric, not its quality. It's about the story that the article tells. Okay? So if I'm writing an article, I will cite people who either support my position because they support it, or I will cite people with whom I have findings that clearly disagree because they disagree, or I will cite findings that are somewhat ambiguous and, boy, my paper is going to solve that problem. Papers are written because of the rhetorical character. You don't just simply generate some data and publish a paper that is, look, my data show such and such. No, no, no. It's always a matter of making the story that is the paper. And that means deciding who to cite, what to cite, how to cite, and so on. In addition to that, different citation measures, of course, lead to different results, and there's been a proliferation of measures out there. Co-authoring is a problem. What do you do in a field where where almost all papers are produced with 50 or 100 or even 1,500, I think, is the top in one field of physics. And then as one scientometrician sums it up, these are the folks who develop all these scales, there's a better way to evaluate the importance of a paper or the research output of an individual scholar. Read it. What a shocking thought. So, okay, well, we can check the prestige of journals. And a great story here is the story of George Akerlof, the Nobel Prize-winning economist. Akerlof sent his famous paper on the market for lemons, which showed that in certain instances, you could actually, if you said, I'm going to sell you a 2011 Cadillac for $50. Well, you wouldn't go near that, right? Because you're suspicious already. This has got to be some sort of scam. Okay, and that's what he wrote about. It was rejected by the American Economic Review, the top journal in the field, and was eventually published in the Quarterly Journal of Economics, a much lower level thing in terms of the prestige of the journal. Okay, he got the Nobel Prize as a result of that. Now, why didn't he get in the top journal? Well, because the top journal was much more fussy about what it was going to accept. It wasn't willing to take the risk of publishing something which countered the prevailing wisdom at the time. In addition to that, we've seen a huge increase in the amount of fraud. One study estimates a tenfold increase in retractions due to fraud since 1975, and this was all in the top science journals like Science, Nature, and so on. And of course, fraud is promoted by the desire to do well in these performance audits. By gosh, you know, I got to get this paper into Science or Nature or some other top journal because that's going to be the thing that's going to give me a good rating. Then we have the problem of whose author is it. We have growing ghost authorship, where the author's name appears nowhere on the article. And we have growing honorary authorship, where the name on the paper is not that of the actual author. And according to one study here of the top six medical journals, 21% of the papers had honorary or ghost authors or both. This is top medical journals. And this, by the way, was an improvement over 10 years ago when this problem was first noticed. Okay? Not too good a story there. Competing for grants. Well, proponents say ensuring that most promising researchers are funded, that they funnel research to the most important topics, that they're the most efficient way to distribute research funds. But the critics note that competitor grants are quite costly, not only because of overhead and things of that sort, which one way or another has to be paid, but because of the enormously complex bureaucracies they require, both in Washington or whatever other funding agency it is, as well as on every campus. Somebody's got to deal with all this incredible management complexity. And of course, as you well know, every granting agency has its own rules, its own regulations, thanks to Congress. And as a result, you can't use the same forms, you can't use the same budgetary. I was once in a situation in which I had an AID project that I was running, which was about $25 million, and two or three other NSF projects. The NSF project asked, what percent of your time? The AID project asked, how many days per week? It was almost impossible to make these things integrate. Okay? Because the percent of my time wasn't based on an eight-hour day, right? It was based on the percent of my time, whereas the other was based on eight-hour days. There was no way you could make these things integrate. The accountants went nuts over it for weeks. Competitor grants also, of course, tend to support what's known as the Matthew effect. That is to say, he who has the gold gets more gold. NIH has noted this particularly as a major problem. People who've had dozens of other NIH grants, when Bill Lacey and I applied for our first NSF grant, we got back this wonderful review. It began, Lacey and Bush, neither of whom do I know, and it went downhill from there. Well, 10 years into the process with a stack of other grants, it was exactly the other way around. It was, oh, well, you know, Bush has done this other stuff, Lacey's done this other stuff. Well, clearly, they can do this. Okay. We also tend to reward through grants that people who are good at grant writing. It doesn't take into account the location-specific character of some research, particularly important for much agricultural and food research. And there's even evidence to suggest that, and all of this is pretty much from agriculture because it's the only field where there's a comparison available, that block grants are actually more effective, at least in terms of productivity, agricultural productivity, perhaps in other ways as well. And they're certainly more efficient in the sense that they don't require these massive bureaucracies. Another thing that's going on in the research area is forced citation by journal editors. This is where the editor accepts the paper for publication on the condition that the author add citations to other articles in the same journal, which raises the ranking of that journal in the journal rankings. And again, there have been a few studies of this, and they show that basically senior faculty will give somebody the finger or something equivalent to that, whereas junior faculty, who desperately need to get that publication to get tenure, will go ahead with it and say, well, I'm annoyed by this, but I'm going to add the extra half dozen citations to totally irrelevant stuff in order to make the journal editor happy. Conflicts of interest. In the past, universities were reluctant to accept private funds. I was going to, but I didn't bother here. But since Scott mentioned it earlier, I'll mention it briefly. Back in the 1920s, at the meetings of the Experiment Station Directors Association, as I think it was called back then, there was a paper given by somebody who said, absolutely under no conditions should you ever accept any money from any private entity. This will destroy the independence of the university. Well, of course, what we have today is faculty is urged to collaborate with the private sector to enter into all sorts of contractual agreements, patents, and copyrights in some instances, and so on. And in some cases, entire departments, as we noted in the Berkeley study, enter into these kinds of things. In some disciplines, we have so few scholars that are not receiving industry support that the whole question of can we find somebody who is not interested in this subject becomes exceedingly difficult, if not impossible, to find. And food science is one of those, but there are others. Another on the conflict of interest side here, is a study of 94 articles that reported health risks and nutritional value of GM crops that in which financial or professional conflict of interest was commonplace when positive findings were reported. Okay. Now, that doesn't mean that all these folks were lying. That's not the point that I want to make. The point is, the very fact that that potential conflict of interest exists poses enormous problems for the credibility of universities as independent institutions that can be trusted by the general public. A lot of this has the effect of discouraging innovation and high-risk research. Constant auditing means churn out more papers. Don't waste time on that dangerous high-risk topic there that might take you 5 years to complete and that might fail. In addition to that, that might threaten the flow of research products. And there is some evidence that negative research is now much less likely to be published. Changes in intellectual property rights, another aspect of this. Universities used to be known almost entirely for producing open products, right? We call them contributions to the discipline or contributions to the public, okay? But proprietary knowledge has become now embedded in universities. Moreover, getting to do research on protected innovations becomes a major issue. So a few years ago, as some of you probably know, a group of entomologists and pathologists wrote an irate letter to the EPA complaining about the impossibility of doing research on the environmental impact of genetically modified crops because the companies that have patents on those simply refuse to allow anybody to do it. Now, it's probably illegal to do that, but not surprisingly, no university wants to bring Monsanto to court because the cost of doing so would bankrupt the university. And then we have, of course, the rise of university IP offices. And if you look at the work that was done on this subject back in when the IP offices were originally developed under the Bayh-Dole Act, it was very clear that the idea here was to get innovations out to the public, to avoid orphan innovations. What has happened, of course, is the IP offices have turned into moneymakers. What you want to do is get as much money out of the IP office as possible. And of course, the obsession with publication has meant that extension and education have been downgraded relative to research, and also all the non-publication activities that faculty engage in, advising graduate students, attending seminars, organizing professional meetings, reviewing papers and grant applications, informal faculty interaction, all of this has basically been pushed to the side. And research is now dominated to an enormous extent by immediate economic ends. How much money will this produce? And again, politicians, to no question, push this very, very hard. We've also seen the rise of dubious journals. I won't say much more about that. And of course, the cost of journals has just gone through the roof. Elsevier had a nice 36% return on revenues, much better than my bank account, on revenues of $3.2 billion in 2010. And they're one of the four or five big academic publishers. We've also seen the rise of strongly ideological think tanks, such as Heritage, Cato, American Enterprise, founded to promote neoliberalism. And these groups are not averse to what Phil Murawski calls agnotology, that is to say, the promotion of doubt about things for which there is very little doubt. So they will do a great job of promoting, well, you know, climate change has been talked about, but, you know, it could be that it's not happening. Acid rain, well, could be that it's not happening. Holes in the ozone, well, could be that it's not, and so on. And when they are insufficiently neoliberal, the large donors attempt to oust the current membership so as to purify the message. So, for example, Jim DeMint recently replaced Edward Fulner as the director of the Heritage Foundation, signaling a movement towards a more rigid stance on a wide range of issues. And similarly, the Koch brothers successfully oust the director of the Cato Institute, who they felt was insufficiently neoliberal for them, and they threatened to sue, and finally the suit was avoided by him stepping down. We've also, of course, seen an increase in corporate domination of the research enterprise. It's important to remember that private investment dwarfs the public in both agriculture and pharmaceuticals. These sectors, of course, themselves are highly dependent on public dollars to do the research that keeps their development activities functioning. But they're the ones who tell the tale. Private research investment dwarfs, a few huge companies, of course, now dominate agricultural industries, all the way from input supply to supermarkets. And these companies can and do, and I don't blame them for doing it, they've been given the license to do that, they steer innovations in order to benefit themselves. And most importantly, much public research is now largely only available by going through companies. This is particularly true of the work in genomics. It's very difficult for you to be a genomicist, or for that matter, any field of genomics, proteomics, metabolomics, and so on. You can't do that and go directly to any public out there. You've got to go through a company. There's been a decline of interest in public interest science. In the past, much experimentation research was focused on practices. The example we just heard a few moments ago about the vintners is a good example of that, right? Much of the change here was a matter of changing your practices. You didn't charge for that. You didn't say, well, you know, this, we've patented this. Now, if you'll just simply pay the university a patent, we'll let you use it. No. And when they, in most cases, the results were provided free. When material objects were provided, they were generally, were produced, they were generally cheap and widely available, and the best example is seeds. So universities were producing seeds for more than a century. We now have a shortage of plant breeders, but that's another subject I won't go into. But this is research that has relatively few market benefits, and hence it is disappearing. And two examples I give here, biological control, which was already mentioned a few moments ago, which has sort of started to fade away, because after all, biological control, once you buy the insects and start raising the insects, you don't need to do much else. You don't need to go back to the market. And apomixis is another example which is directly relevant to genetic modification. It's a great irony. Apomixis, for those of you who are not familiar, is the replacement of sexual by asexual reproduction in plants. And it produces cultivars that are genetically identical to the parent. So it's like producing a hybrid that will self-replicate. Well, from a farmer's vantage point, this would be wonderful, right? I buy my whatever the plant is. I buy the seeds. I plant them. The seeds are harvested. I plant them again. I can do that through maybe four or five generations before there's any significant drift. But of course, from a market perspective, this is an absolute disaster. You don't want those blasted genetically modified geneticists and genomicists focusing on this kind of stuff, because this is going to undermine the market. Let me move to extension in the few minutes that remain. Of course, the farm population's decline is in part linked to the decline in support for extension. But I would also argue that, at least looked at nationally, extension has failed to change or enlarge its support base. It's tended to avoid controversial topics. I was delighted to hear about those two women in Oklahoma who were doing some really exciting things, from what I could tell. And the extension model that's used is often obsolete. It looks like this. And this is the model developed by the late Hugh Bunting, a British agronomist, who Bill and I got a chance to meet many years ago. And he said that the way it works is the researcher shoots an arrow through the extension agent into the farmer. Okay. A one-way street, that's the way that it goes. And we've also seen, of course, the rise of private extension-like services. To neoliberals, this is wonderful. Extension is an interference in what would otherwise be a flourishing market for farm services. Just get out of the way. And these services, of course, are growing as money for extension declines. Naturally, they exclude those who are unable to pay, and they change the nature of the services provided. since very often these services focus heavily on the product, purchase of a product. So we'll tell you which variety is the best one to grow, but it happens to be ours. And it's the most expensive one that we have. There's also a growing gap between research and extension. Despite some of the things that were said here today, again, this is not everywhere, not every single case, but much of the research that's done simply can't be used by farmers, not directly. It has to go through the private sector first. So I would argue extension needs to rethink this one-way model to the extent that it still dominates, and that every university needs a cooperative intention service. That is to say, you need to make this thing work both ways, again, as was suggested very nicely in the presentation about grape growers. And finally, the university is seen as a growth machine. Universities are not just simply to be producing things that are economically potentially interesting, but rather they're the engines of economic development. Now, all of this would be of minor import were it not for the major crises we're facing. And here are a few of them. I won't even bother to say more than that. You can read them for yourselves. The point is that these crises are wicked problems. They cannot be resolved through problem solving, puzzle solving. Each requires changes in technologies, in laws, in standards, in norms. And doing one thing, making one thing start to disappear, means you suddenly create another problem over there. Grappling with these problems is a necessity. We can't just ignore them. They're a necessity for us, but they're also a necessity for future generations. If we don't do something about them, we leave an enormous burden to our grandchildren. And although my 5-year-old grandson is strong, he isn't strong to carry that. So this leaves us with two major questions then for land-grant universities. What kinds of selves should land-grant universities produce? And what kinds of universities should land-grant universities be? Now, the second one of these questions has been answered thousands of times. You heard some of the versions of these answers a few moments ago. But I would argue that the answering the question requires a double answer. That is to say, we not only need to provide answers about the kind of institutions we want to construct, but that question by definition implies that we ask what kind of faculty, what kind of students, what kind of extension staff, and what kind of stakeholders we should have. Now, you might think this question, what kind of selves do we want? This is outrageous. Isn't this a form of social engineering? Shouldn't people be free to decide what kinds of selves they want without the interference from institutions of higher education? But this is precisely the point. There is no way to produce selves who are completely free of the influence of others and institutions. This has even been demonstrated by some recent brain research, which demonstrates that if in the first 3 months or so of life you don't have interaction with other human beings, the neural pathways necessary for future development don't exist. They never grow. Okay? So we are fundamentally social. We're neither fully autonomous, nor are we fully social. So we're not like bees who, for all practical purposes, are fully social. They receive signals, chemical signals. Those chemical signals tell those bees what to do. They even tell the bees whether to be female or queen. Now, during the heyday of state socialism, much effort was given to molding selves to support the state. Since the Cold War ended, the effort to mold selves as autonomous, market-oriented actors, that is to say, as the ideal participants in a market society, has emerged as its replacement. This is just a mirror image of state socialism. This is not an alternative. This is just state socialism turned on its head. To achieve liberty, I would argue, you can't force everyone into a predefined mold. Liberty and freedom require that people become reflexively aware of how others influence their self-formation, that they have the ability to decide, within the limits of social life, what kinds of selves they want to have or be, and that they acquire the wherewithal to change their selves over the course of their life course. So today I might want to be this kind of self. By the way, we all do this on a daily basis, right? The self that I display here is not the one I display to my wife. It's not the one I display to my grandkids. Everybody has multiple selves. That's normal. And we have multiple selves both over space and time. So what changes might help us to design new and better universities, as well as new and better selves? First of all, I think we need to provide security for those who inhabit universities. We've moved from a place where universities were places where you could pursue education or research or extension with security to one in which insecurity is promoted through incessant audits, through fewer people through fewer people protected against summary dismissal, through high student deaths, and a whole variety of other things that have been put in place, knowingly or unknowingly, over the course of the last several decades. We need to build learning communities. That is to say, communities in which everyone is learning. Again, the one you heard about, viticulture, I think is a great example of that kind of thing. But we need to do that on a regular basis across all disciplines. We need to reform or abolish the credit hour, which is based on the rather absurd notion that the amount of time that a faculty member spends in front of a classroom is a good measure of how much work they're doing in education, and that the amount of time a student sits in a classroom is also a good measure of how well-educated they are. Both are false, fundamentally false. And there was a very interesting article in the Chronicle a few weeks ago pointing out how this notion of credit hour was developed by the Carnegie Corporation back in the beginning of the 20th century as a way of dealing with pensions for faculty members. It had absolutely nothing to do with the quality of instruction. Quite extraordinary. We also need to, I would argue, to eliminate standardized testing. Standardized testing tests for all the things we don't need to know about. There might be a few exceptions to that. Maybe it makes sense to have standardized tests to see whether somebody can solve some math problems. Maybe it makes sense to have standardized tests to see if somebody has learned a foreign language. But I would argue that anything that requires higher level skills, critical thinking skills, is poorly served by standardized testing. And we need to eliminate the use of classroom lectures. Classroom lectures are less and less useful. The evidence is quite, this is really strange. My mouse has just simply vanished. Oh well. The classroom lecture, it's been quite well demonstrated by dozens of studies in education that most of it people don't remember. That may include the lecture I'm giving right now. You can decide that for yourselves afterwards. It makes much more sense to turn this around the other way. And that is to say, use the information technologies to tear down the walls between classrooms and the world. We can use IT to invert and vastly improve the usual lecture discussion format. We can ask students to listen online to lectures, or to read texts, or to listen to podcasts, or some other kind of electronic form of communication. And then we can have them come to class to discuss those things. Right? So why in the world do we want people to sit in a room bored to tears for an hour and a half, when in fact you could do that stuff at your leisure when you want to do it, in your dorm room or in wherever you live? You could do it with some friends and laugh over the bizarre clothing that the lecturer has or how utterly unintelligible it is, and then come to class and discuss serious stuff. We need to make more of education into group projects. The fact is that most of us are going to spend most of our lives working in groups, but we treat education as if it was entirely an individual thing. And one example which I want to mention here, one of my colleagues at Michigan State has done an absolutely fabulous job. He's a biologist, and he has a class in which the students do a research experiment on popcorn popping. And they do the literature review, they design the